Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. It's a nice rainy day here in Phoenix. So those of us who did not commute don't have to worry about it, but the public has been notified that this meeting is virtual. So I hope none of us had to commute to be at this meeting. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Davy?
Present.
Thank you. Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff? Dr. Stewart?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Remarks and announcements. Please keep in mind that the times stated on the agenda are approximate, and the board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one item, go to a different item, and then come back to the previously tabled item. And the board may also reorder non-timed items. Just as a heads up, today's meeting does not have any timed items, but we do have some accommodation requests depending on people's schedules. Board members, thank you for continuing to use the raise hand feature. I know everybody's has done an excellent job with that, so let's continue that trend. It just helps everybody. Board survey, the board encourages everyone in attendance to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link to that on the meetings page that is posted on the board's website. I always take this time to appreciate all of our board members and staff and our representatives from the AG's office for helping have a substantive and efficient meeting. I know they spend many hours in getting prepared, so I do commend all of the hard work and effort that goes into having these meetings. Continuing education credit. Attendance at the board meeting is eligible for continuing education if it is at least 4 hours long. If the duration is 4 hours or more, then keep making note of the code words that would be provided throughout the meeting. To report the code words to board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meetings page for this particular meeting. Within the next several weeks, board staff will verify the licensees' earned credits in their CE broker accounts. Please also note that the meeting may not be 4 hours long in duration, and therefore it is possible that continuing education credits will not be awarded. So thank you for your understanding. Call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. According to ARS Section 38-431.02, subsection H, the board can only take actions on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda if applicable. So if you wish to speak, now is the time. Please unmute yourselves and state your name, and then I'll call on you. All right, hearing none, let's move on to number five on the agenda, which is council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any updates? And I also want to recognize Ms. Campbell, who is from the AG's office, who will be assisting the board today. Ms. Galvin.
Good morning. This is Jean Galvin. The only update is the same as last month. The formal hearing for the Jamie Jones matter, who is she's a behavior analyst, is continued till later in this month. Beth Campbell was here, but she stepped off. She is going to be providing you legal advice. I have to jump off slightly before 10 as I'm acting as an independent advisor for another board. Hopefully that won't take too long, but Beth will be here. She's met with staff and prepped on the issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gavin. So number six is consent agenda. And I'm going to sort of take an unusual step of calling for executive session. That's my motion. If there is a second, we can go into executive session for legal advice.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair, you're muted.
I wanted to get that wrinkle out of the way right away. So it's 8:47 and we are back in open session. We are on the consent agenda. Do any board members wish to note recusals or abstentions from items on the consent agenda? Dr. Seidman.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Diner. I will be abstaining from item 1B and 1E. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, board members can request to remove an item from the consent agenda for separate discussion and action. Are there any such requests? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
So moved.
Okay. Dr. Stewart's motion and second by Dr. Medina. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed with the noted abstention. The items on the consent agenda are approved. Ms. Pakkinen, which item should we go to next?
Mr. Chair, I think we're going to proceed in order for at least for now with 7, and then we can move to 8 and 9 after that.
Thank you. Okay, so number 7 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding complaint number 25-41 against Natalie Torres, including but not limited to the possible summary suspension of her license to practice behavior analysis, referral to formal hearing, or other administrative remedies available to the board. Ms. Michelson, will you please summarize the matter for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In 2023, Ms. Torres was issued her behavior analyst license by the board. In approximately November of 2024, she began working as a behavior analyst for a behavior analytic company in Tucson. On February 20th, the board received a complaint from the company's ABA director, a licensed behavior analyst, indicating that Ms. Torres's employment was terminated on February 11th for a violation of their policies regarding drug use. According to the complaint, in late January, it was reported to the complainant KD that Ms. Torres was falling asleep during her supervision of a client. KD met with Ms. Torres, who reported that she was not aware she was falling asleep and that she did not have any issues of concern to address. On February 6th, during a clinical staffing meeting, KD observed that Ms. Torres was falling asleep. She denied being tired or falling asleep at that time. She was escorted later that day to a facility to undergo a urine drug test. The agency received the results on February 11th, which were positive for cocaine. Her employment was terminated on that same date. The executive director and I subsequently contacted Ms. Torres to discuss these complaint allegations. During the call, Ms. Torres stated that she does not use any illegal drugs, and she is unsure why the urine drug screen was positive for cocaine. She suggested that maybe the test results were positive, as she had recently traveled to Las Vegas and went to several bars and consumed alcohol. She hypothesized that perhaps something may have happened to one of her drinks. At the conclusion of our call, it was requested that Ms. Torres submit to a hair test for legal substances, as she had disputed the urine drug screen that she previously submitted to as requested by her employer. She did ultimately submit to that hair test on February 24th. A few days later, we did receive those results, which were positive for cocaine. Those results are in your materials. I do want to also note, on February 24th, I notified Ms. Torres by email that the board would be reviewing this complaint today. In my correspondence, she was also informed that a written response to the allegations was due by March 4th. She did not reply to that correspondence, so I did send a follow-up email on March 4th, determining when the board could expect to receive a response and also asking for confirmation about her participation today. As of this morning, I have not received any correspondence from Ms. Torres. So this concludes my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions. I do see that we have the complainant present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Michelson at this time? Hearing none, let's go to Katie. Thank you for being here. You may unmute yourself and you may wish to make a statement, and then I'm sure some of us will have questions for you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, before I have one question for Ms. Ms. Michelson, if appropriate.
Sure, yeah.
In terms of, I know we have her past employer, do we have also information on a current employer?
Dr. Davey and board members, when Ms. Pakanon and I spoke with her approximately a week ago, we did inquire with her if she had either recently applied for any positions or had started working anywhere. She indicated that she had applied and interviewed for several positions as a BCBA and was expected to start on March 17th. That was the last information that was made known to staff.
Thank you.
Thank you. Katie, let's go to you. Thank you again for being here.
Hi. Yes. Thank you for having me. I'm just here on behalf. I witnessed Ms. Torres in the clinic setting on two occasions falling asleep. One time was in the presence of her client. I was called by another behavior analyst and two behavior techs that were in the room when she fell asleep in front of her computer, and took two people just to kind of make some loud noises to get her awake. When I met with her shortly after remotely, because I'm located in Phoenix, I wasn't there for that instance. She said she wasn't feeling tired, and asked if she's on any cold medicine, anything that could just, you know, be extra tired that day. She said she wasn't aware she fell asleep. She wasn't tired. She felt fine. I reported to the clinic that Monday to meet with her to go over some of her programmings and just to see how she was doing during our meeting together. She dozed off and fell asleep in the middle of our conversation. Another behavior analyst and supervisor and were present during that meeting when she did doze off during our meeting. And this is in a clinic where she was overseeing a total of five kiddos.
Thank you, Katie. Any questions board members might have for Katie at this time? Yes, Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Thank you for being here, Katie. What was the explanation for falling asleep that you got from then Ms. Torres, I guess, on Monday when you were meeting with her in the incident? I guess this would have been the second incident that took place.
Yeah, so I did tell her, I was like, I've noted that you fell asleep, and she looked at me kind of surprised and was like, yeah, I wasn't aware I fell asleep. And I let her know that, you know, I talked to HR kind of previously about it and got the okay that if I had seen anything or it was witnessed by more than one person, that I could take her to drug testing immediately. So I just let her know that for the safety of the kiddos, we just wanted to rule out any substances or drug use, since she says she's not falling asleep and not aware of it. She didn't have much to say in that moment, waited until we got the paperwork. We drove to drug testing. She didn't deny anything. She didn't admit anything. She was fairly quiet. And then I let her know, asked her if she had any questions. She said she had no questions. And I just let her know that she was just on leave until we, pending the results.
Thank you. No other questions.
And Katie, what, to the extent you know, what is Ms. Torres's current job status? Was she let go from her previous employer, or did she resign?
We terminated her employment once we received her drug test results.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions for KD? Dr. Davey?
No question. I'd like to make a motion to move to executive session.
I'll second that.
For legal advice?
Yes, for legal advice.
Motion on the table. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, it is 9:06. We are back in open session. We are on agenda item number 7, Dr. Davey. You're muted.
Sorry about that. I think that's automatic when we come back. I got to pay closer attention. I just want to note for my fellow committee, fellow board members and the public that in reviewing the information for this applicant, this licensee, it appears that she had applied for a job with the agency that I am currently employed with. However, I have no prior knowledge of this individual. I have no relationship with her, and therefore believe that I can move forward in adjudicating this matter in an unbiased fashion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. So at this time, let me see Dr. Stewart.
If the chair would entertain a motion.
Sure.
For a summary suspension of the licensee.
Dr. Stewart, can we table that because I want to see if Ms. Torres is available for questioning?
Okay. Thank I'll you. Withdraw that.
Ms. Torres, if you're in this meeting, now would be the time to unmute yourself. You may wish to make a statement of up to 5 minutes, and then we might have questions for you. For the record, I don't see Ms. Torres in the participants list, but I do note that there are a few phone numbers that I don't know if that's one of, that would be Ms. Torres. But if you are on the phone, there is like an extra step, like a *6 or something that you need to unmute yourself. So I'll give you another 10, 15 seconds.
Mr. Chair, I did cross-reference the number, phone number that we have on record. It is not among those that are present in the meeting.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. Okay, so then we'll note Ms. Torres's absence from this meeting. And is there any discussion or motion? Dr. Stewart.
Yes, if the chair would entertain, I'd resurrect my motion to for the board to summary suspend the licensee.
Second.
All right, there's a motion and a second. A discussion, Ms. Galvin, I was going to note the findings of fact for purposes of the motion.
Yes, if the board is considering a summary suspension, there is a legal advice memorandum that was provided to the board. And a series of motions is required when you are summarily suspending.
Okay, so Dr. Stewart, you may have to withdraw your motion for the time being because we need to do findings of fact first.
I withdraw my motion.
Thank you. And the second is withdrawn as well.
Likewise.
Thank you. Okay, so is there a motion for findings of fact, Dr. Flint?
Based upon the information and evidence presented to the board and as set forth in the interim finding of fact and conclusions of law, I move that the board adopt the interim findings of fact and conclusions of law while finding that the interim finding of fact and conclusions of law require emergency action to protect the public health, safety, and welfare.
Second.
Thank you. There is a second by Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, just as a point of discussion, is this where we would list the finding of fact, Ms. Galvin?
The findings of fact are laid out in the document, so you don't need to for, you don't need to repeat them. Dr. Flint referenced that document and her motion included that those findings be adopted. And those findings include the finding that emergency action is required.
That's fine. I just think for the record, we should make a statement that, you know, the evidence suggests that Ms. Torres engaged in unprofessional conduct by arriving at her place of employment under the influence of an illicit substance and subsequently tested positive. And then as a follow-up, tested positive again. And I think it's important that the public understand that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Any further discussion?
Is there a consensus that a finding similar to that should be included? I think it's included in the interim findings. It was noted that she appeared at the meeting. She was witnessed by others to, you know, fall asleep. A subsequent test confirmed illicit drugs. But if we need more than that, I'll be happy to revise them.
Dr. Davey.
Mr. Chair, no, Ms. Govan, thank you. I just wanted to, you know, we have documents in front of us that the public doesn't. I just wanted to say that out loud. So
okay, yeah. And it'll be public once it is in effect.
Thank you.
And Ms. Galvin, that actually reminds me, there was, we heard from KD, and then based on Dr. Davey's disclosure, there may have been some misrepresentation on Ms. Torres's part to the board as to her current employment. Would that be something that goes into the findings of fact as an additional fact?
I don't believe that we have enough evidence as far as the timing of accepting positions, rejecting positions, telling the board, you know, where she might go next. So I would not feel comfortable adding that allegation at this time. And I believe the summary suspension and the evidence to drug tests positive for cocaine is sufficient for the summary suspension.
Thank you. Okay, so there's a motion. Do we need a roll call?
Not on this part, not on this motion.
Okay, so voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Dr. Flint.
I have another motion, Mr. Chair. Given these findings, I move that the board summarily suspend the license of Ms. Torres, license number BEH-001262, effective upon service of the order.
Second.
Second by Dr. Medina. Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, so roll call, Ms. Poe, on this motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Diner?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. Dr. Flint.
Mr. Chair, a third motion, please. Finally, I move that the executive director, refer this matter to formal hearing before the Office of Administrative Hearings for the revocation or summary suspension of Ms. Torres's license, and that the hearing be commenced as expeditiously as possible from the date of the issuance of this order.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, could someone offer a friendly amendment that the matter be referred either to the Office of Administrative Hearings or before the board? I understand from staff that it most likely will be heard by the board.
Dr. Flint, would that be acceptable?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My second stands.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? And Ms. Galvin, is this voice vote or roll call?
It's because you were asking for a revocation, I would ask for a roll call.
Okay. Ms. Poe, roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Diner?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. Okay, that concludes our item number 7. Ms. Pakkinen, can I go to number 8?
Yes, Mr. Chair, please do.
Okay. Number 8 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding Arizona Attorney General Office's Licensing Enforcement Section Notice of Representation Letter. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please summarize this for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. As the communication from Section Chief Mark Harris, the Section Chief specifically of the Licensing and Enforcement Section of the Attorney General's Office reflects, due to a modification of the rules of procedure in Arizona, the Attorney General's Office is now issuing what is a formal notice of representation to the directors of Arizona state agencies. This is not new information. It's essentially a perfunctory exercise, but Mr. Harris wanted the board to be aware of this new requirement and that it has been fulfilled. Much of what his letter outlines is language closely emulates the language that is in our service agreement between our agency and the Attorney General's office. So there is nothing novel in this letter that agencies don't already know or should already know. But this is just, again, a formal issuance of this type of notice that the board office will keep on file. I can answer some questions potentially. Ms. Galvin, of course, is your best resource if you have questions about any of the content of this notice.
Thank you. So question would be, does this change anything in the service agreement, or does the letter sort of supersede the service agreement or go hand in hand with the service agreement?
It goes hand in hand, and the letter is simply a requirement under the change in the ethical rules that attorneys have. If you work for the government, this type of notice has to be sent on an annual basis. So that's really all it is. No action is necessary. It'll just be recorded in the minutes that you've received it, reviewed it.
Any further questions? All right, then there's no action needed on this. And thank you to Mr. Harris in absentia for doing this, because periodic reminders like this are helpful. And now it's on file. We have reviewed it. Okay, Ms. Pakkinen, can we go to number 9?
Yes, please.
Okay. 9 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding financial year 2025 appropriation shortfall and ensuing implications to the Arizona Attorney General interagency agreement. And Ms. Pakkinen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My memorandum summarizes both the history of this issue, the short-term solution that I was compelled to arrive at to address the issue. And then I also want to speak to the long-term strategy. So I'll kind of take those pieces in order. And just for purposes of, full transparency for the public, we have been tracking for some time since really late 2022 in 2023 and to the present, a concerning trend specific to our agency's costs that are they're categorized as ERE, employee-related expenses. So hereafter, I will refer to this collection of expenses as ERE. ERE is, in a formulaic way, is estimated by both the Governor's Office of Strategic Planning and Budget and by the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. They've arrived at agreed upon ERE should be 45% of payroll costs or what we call personal services. So anytime that value exceeds 45%, it will have an impact on the utilization of the appropriation. And the appropriation is an unforgiving number. It is an absolute ceiling that any agency cannot spend above. So when a figure, a value of that size, and with that disparity in terms of a percentage increase, when that trend occurs, it is very concerning. I do explain how, when my awareness grew of this issue in 2020, fiscal year 2023, how I sought from OSPB, the Governor's Office of Strategic Planning and Budget, some relief in the form of a request to increase our appropriation because, for whatever reason, we seem to be, an outlier of an agency relative to these costs. OSPB rejected that request. It was for a mere $12,000 to help us bridge that funding gap. The problem is of a severe magnitude right now. What I'm finding is that my most recent analysis through the 7th month of the fiscal year is that we are approaching 53% ERE. That is, in terms of real dollars, a shortfall, an appropriation shortfall of nearly $24,000. So I have raised, yet again, I have made attempts to raise awareness with OSPB, with JLBC, with the governor's office, with the Department of Administration, as it relates to our benefits division of that agency, that this is an extreme pain point for which there is no ideal solution. So the analysis that I had to perform with such a deficit, appropriation deficit looming, I had to look at the financial or the expense categories where we could possibly make cuts. And as a practical matter, there were only two, one of which is payroll itself. To me, that is a non-starter because if we reduce the hours that our employees work, everything suffers. Application processing, complaints, adjudication, investigation, the functioning of this agency is adversely impacted. Moreover, that would be perceived to be a punishment unfairly to the employees who, in good faith, exercised their rights to choose the benefit elections that they did. So I had to eliminate that from consideration. That left only one area of spending, which was the 4th quarter of our interagency service agreement with the Attorney General's office. I have provided that notice to Mr. Harris, and the contract that we have concludes as of March 31st of 2025. This isn't to mean that we will not have legal representation. As you just heard, the Attorney General's office assures state agencies they will have legal representation. What we don't know is whether, how, if that representation will look any different for the months of April, May, and June. July presents us with an opportunity for a reset. It is a new fiscal year. And if I get my way, we will have a supplemental increase, secure one in fiscal 26 to rectify this problem. That is what ultimately I am imploring for. But I don't have that clarity here now and today. So I wish I could give you insights in terms of what our representation, what if any changes we will see in that 3 month period. I can only assure this board that we will get through it as best as we can. We don't have an alternative. I want to come back to something I alluded to with respect to the employees. I've had a conversation with them, and I have explained to them in no uncertain terms they should not feel guilty. They should not feel any sense of remorse because they've earned the right to select from an array of benefits that the state of Arizona promises them. I feel that that conversation went very well, and the staff is not feeling on any level culpable for this problem. The problem is purely this. It is based on a systemic and flawed methodology and set of assumptions that frankly don't work with every state agency's circumstances. We are a very small agency. We only have 5 employees who that determine what cumulatively, categorically, what those ERE costs will be. Large agencies likely have the ability, just through averages, to be able to meet that general target of 45%. For whatever reason, we don't. We exceed it. What's also flawed about this entire process is that if this problem is discovered, whether it's by the psychology board, the PT board, the osteopathic medical board, any agency that's small, if this is discovered at some point in the fiscal year, there is no latitude, there is no solution, there's no bridge solution, if you will, to address what were unforeseen costs, again, based on a deeply flawed methodology and estimating approach. So I don't know if this could possibly be reformed in any systemic way, but right now I'm just looking for relief, and relief as soon as possible. And the as soon as possible is July 1. So with that, I think I'll pause and I will take questions from the board. Maybe one more time, reiterate that our staff deserves everything that they are offered. And I want that to be absolutely clear on the record.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. I mean, and truly, this is quite concerning. And you put it quite diplomatically. I have some stronger words that I may not want to state on the record, but it's really, it's a huge problem for the board, and there isn't any effective engagement, at least from what I have seen from the legislature on this topic. We have raised these concerns, as Ms. Pakkanen noted, in multiple places, every avenue has been explored, but you know, at some point there needs to be a desire from the political branches of government, meaning the legislature and maybe the governor's office, in taking these calls for help seriously. And I don't, as Ms. Pakkanen said, there we have explored everything that we could do on this topic. It's just unfortunate that we are where we are. So,
yes, Mr. Chair, if Dr. Flint doesn't mind, I do want to respond to that briefly. Maybe, Mr. Chair, where you feel reserved, I'm perhaps less so. I have made it abundantly clear to specifically, to both offices that play a role in what ultimately amounts to our appropriation, every state agency's appropriation. I have not been reserved about informing OSPB. In particular, I asked for an adjustment of this amount at the time that we identified the problem. That was rejected. I'm also telling that office, here is another instance where I informed you that the cost of the ISA for legal services also increased from fiscal 23 to 24. That too was rejected. The strong word, I know, absurdity of this all is that at the time the board had $1.7 million in its fund that the legislature elected to sweep not long thereafter. It's not as though we didn't have the funds sitting there available for use. We just couldn't secure the permission to spend them. And if you have suffered through, I think you have, reading my funding request justifications, I don't know what else I can do to make the case that these costs are squeezing us to the point of having to make these very consequential decisions. And in the process, we inflict pain on a general fund agency. So what could have been leveraged in the form of fees that we collected, again, just sitting there, could have circumvented this problem where a general fund agency is forced to be the solution. Thank you.
Thank you. And sorry, Dr. Flynn, I promise I get to you. But so we are a 9-10 board. So, I mean, our funds come from fees from paid by licensees for license renewals. 10% of that goes into the general fund and 90% of that stays with the board for conducting board's business. But in order to spend that money, we need the legislature's permission every year in the appropriations bill to appropriate those funds and actually use them. So there was the funding sweep happened last year. And so basically the money that was in the psychology board's fund was taken and put in the general fund. Again, the legislature can do that, I suppose, because the legislature created 9-10 boards to begin with. But yeah, it's just the funding aspect of that is just quite disappointing the way all of that has happened over the years. And again, there is no reason to do that because at least, you know, if I were a fully rational sort of person in an ideal scenario, there would be no reason to do that. But here we are. Dr. Flint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. You went, Ms. Pakkinen, to exactly the place that I was wondering if there was a connection to the sweep of last year. So thank you for the clarification of that. So I will leave it at this. This staff works incredibly hard, incredibly hard. And to have any other feeling other than their efforts and their pay is woefully inadequate already. But to suggest anything other than their stellar work needs to be supported. I'm hoping that nobody leaves this meeting thinking that, you know, that a squeeze could have happened somewhere else, because that's, I believe, to be very untrue. Just this morning, we've needed legal advice from our expert multiple times, and to be in a position where we are forced to have any alteration to that is, you use the overall term absurd. I will use the word absolutely unacceptable. And if there is anything that I can do as a board member, I would like that direction. And I will leave it with that comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
I absolutely concur with Dr. Flint and her assessment. And I also was going to the place of asking if the state's sweep of the funds for the Board of Psychologists Examiners was the etiology of the problem. I also believe, as Ms. Pakkinen has said and Dr. Flint reiterated, that our staff members, our board staff, were exceptional. That also includes Ms. Galvin as AAG for this board. And I think that the state of Arizona, and I'm using this word as sarcastically as possible, in its wisdom, by sweeping those funds is just flat out inappropriate. Thank you.
Dr. Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Beck and I knew I had a discussion about this previously with regard to what board members can do, right? So opening up lines of communication to your elected officials to your representatives, to your senators, letting them know that you serve on this board and that you have concerns about how the REs are being calculated and the shortcomings of this board to be able to operate. I think appropriate step if you're so inclined.
I see Ms. Pakkinen nodding yes. Ms. Pakkinen.
Thank you. And thank you for that reminder, Dr. Davey. What I just want to say is that, what I'm observing, I hope the staff observes as well. It's one thing for, their leader, their coach, as I prefer to consider myself, to assure them of their value, and that the value is, it is underappropriated is the shameful part of this, but notwithstanding that, their value to this agency is, everyone stated it so, so beautifully. So it's one thing for me to say that, but for the board staff to hear what the board members have to say is incredibly gratifying to me. And I hope they're receiving it the same way that I am. So thank you very much.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. What I'd like to do, thanks. I appreciate all of this conversation and encourage the public members that are listening to this meeting today to also take note of the discussion and remember that the board is working to protect consumers. And that's an important comment, I believe, and you can do things as well. So Dr. Davey mentioned contacting the legislatures and making that comment too, that this is a concern for you as well. And I know there are psychologist members out there and students and other folks out there. So just a quick comment there. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I second everything that has been said. I think this is a great example to show, how we do in the government and how protecting the public are. It's all intertwined, and we all need to work together to ensure that the public and what we've been tasked to do can be done. We could not do the work that we do without the board staff. And they already work, so much. And I could not imagine doing what we've been asked to do without them. I could not imagine having these meetings without legal counsel. And as it was pointed out, we've used it already, several times in the 1 hour and 10 minutes that the meeting has been going on this morning. And so I do know that our training cohort is present today, and I hope that it's a learning and educational experience in seeing how what we do and how we communicate with the powers that be, our senators or representatives, can have an impact in our profession as psychologists and behavior analysts. So thank you. And that will be on our list of tasks to get done, hopefully, to get that done. Thank you very much. And I appreciate the work that the board staff does and the legal counsel that we are able to receive. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I just put one more comment out there on the record briefly? So I as much as said this, but there are so few places in our budget to look to make cuts. Can I shave, $70 off of one projected expense category? Sure. Will we spend all of our budget that we assumed we would need for office supplies? Hopefully not. So, you know, maybe I can recover $200 in that budget category. But every effort, every place that I looked did not come anywhere close to that $24,000 gap. What did get sacrificed, and it is truly one of the few places in the budget where we have, I would categorize them as discretionary funds, discretionary spending, is travel. So there will not be an Arizona presence, tragically, at the mid-year meeting of ASPPB next month. That's a very difficult thing for me to process because of the importance of how this group of regulators, the opportunities that they have to engage with other regulators from other jurisdictions, to learn, to share best practices, to learn about innovations coming from ASPPB and elsewhere. So that opportunity is lost to us. And that is one of the other very unfortunate outcomes.
All right, then I guess, I mean, we don't need a motion, but we all sort of understand the gravity of the situation and the action items that in our individual capacities we can take to maybe bring some relief to the situation. So I want to keep in mind that we want to take a break around 10 or 10:30, but Ms. Pakkanen, I think number 10 can be quick enough that we can take a break in the next half hour.
And Mr. Chairman, this is Ms. Poe. I would like to give out the first CE code word. The first CE code word is rigatoni. Rigatoni. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I concur, Mr. Chair. Let's do number 10.
Okay. Thank you. So number 10 is discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to the proposed consent agreement for voluntary surrender signed by Susan Schwartz, PhD, for case number 24-30 or other administrative remedies available to the board. Ms. Michelson, will you please summarize for us this matter?
Of course, Mr. Chair. This matter pertains to a complaint that was filed by Dr. Schwartz's former client, initials KG. During the board's review of this case at different stages in the process, several concerns were identified by the board relative to her record keeping and billing practices, among other issues identified with the complaint. More recently, the board conducted an informal interview back on November 8th. The board's discussion reflected significant concerns relative to Dr. Schwartz's billing and other practices as well. The board discussed the additional clarity into her practice management and ability to competently practice at the present time is necessary prior to making a final determination in this matter. After deliberation at the informal interview, the board voted to conduct an additional investigation by issuing an interim order for different evaluations. The board did indicate that as an alternative option, it would be willing to accept a voluntary surrender of Dr. Schwartz's license, which would be in the form of a consent agreement. Subsequent to that meeting, her attorney, Mr. Beardsley, indicated that she had made the decision to surrender her license, and she has signed a proposed consent agreement for the surrender of her license, which is before the board today for consideration. This would serve as a final disposition for the case if approved, and it would go into effect immediately upon processing by staff. It is a disciplinary action and a public record as well. I do just want to note that upon receiving this signed consent agreement, I did inquire with Mr. Beardsley, I believe, back on February 12th for clarification regarding the status of her practice, as it was unclear at that time if she was still treating patients or had closed her practice. It was reported to me that she was treating 17 clients prior to her decision to surrendering her license, and that upon making that decision, she had informed all clients that she would only be available to treat them for approximately a month or so. It was also indicated that she had already provided referrals to each of these clients for continuing care. So I would certainly encourage the board today to seek clarification from Dr. Schwartz regarding the status of her practice before making a decision on the proposed consent agreement that is before you today. So please let me know if there are any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Michelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I remember correctly, was she also licensed in other states or was it only in Arizona? And I just want to make sure that this will go to the National Data Bank almost immediately, correct?
Dr. Davey and board members, it is a disciplinary action. So if this consent agreement is approved, we are required to post it to the website and report to the National Practitioners Data Bank. I will have to double check. I do not recall that she has held a license in any other states. So I will check on that, but you can also ask Mr. Beardsley to clarify as well.
Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Michelson? Hearing none, I see Mr. Beardsley, you're here, and Dr. Schwartz, you're here as well. Thank you for being here. So maybe if you want to make a statement, but I think there are two questions on the table. One is clarifying the status with the current clients, and second is licensure in other states. So Mr. Beardsley or Dr. Schwartz, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Michelson accurately summarized the wind down of Dr. Schwartz's practice. She has concluded her treatment relationship with all of 17 of the clients she was seeing prior to making this decision. Since then, she's provided referrals, and I believe the last day that she met with them has already passed. There was a second question regarding whether she's licensed in any other states. She was previously licensed in New Mexico, but that license lapsed several years ago. She allowed it to lapse. So my client is here, as you noted, Mr. Chair. She's happy to answer any additional questions there are pertaining to the wind down of her practice.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Schwartz or Mr. Beardsley at this time from board members? Hearing none, any discussion or motion? Dr. Stewart.
I move that the board accept Dr. Schwartz's agreement to revoke her license to let it lapse.
Second.
So just to clarify, the motion is to accept the consent agreement for voluntary surrender?
Yes, okay. Ma'am.
And we will need a roll call.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Dunner?
Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I'd just like to add, I appreciate Dr. Schwartz's participation in this. I know it's been very painful for her over this process, but I think that goes to her strength of character. I think she's well-trained. I think that with the juxtaposition of guidelines from a non-governmental agency, membership agency versus a licensing agency, that, decisions were made that led to this. But I appreciate her willingness to stick with us and to unfortunately reach this end. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All right, Ms. Poe, roll call.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Diner?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe.
I just want to note for the record that the complainant KG was here, and it appears she had muted herself attempting to make a statement. So it'd be at your discretion if you would allow her to address the board.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson, for noting that. But I think the matter is closed and has been fully aired. So thank you to the complainant for being here. you have been heard before, and I do acknowledge your participation in this process as well. Okay, so it's 9:49. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back at 9:55. Okay, yeah, we can go to number 15.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. I'm done. I just finished. So y'all can, I mean, if you want to go with me next, that's great. But I got done early, so here I am. I'm ready. Appreciate it. Sure.
Yeah. Well, let's do 15 now that we are here, right? Let me first confirm we have quorum. Okay, I think we have, I see six. It's 9:57. We are back in, or we are in open session. And number 15 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding telehealth registry annual update and report submitted by Tatiana Del Toro, BCBA, pursuant to ARS section 36-3606, subsection A9. Also request by Tatiana Del Toro to approve the relinquishment of her telehealth registry authorization. Ms. Pakkanen, the floor is yours.
Oh, forgive me, Mr. Chair. I gave you the wrong number. I meant agenda item 13. Ms. Stark is associated with that item, so I apologize.
Yeah,
I said 15,
no worries.
I meant 13. But you got extra practice by articulating the agenda item language. Thank you.
I did. Thank you. Well, let's table number 15 and go to number 13, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the Committee on Behavior Analysts' recommendation to dismiss complaint number 25-03 against Neda Nazrabadi Gauka, M.Ed. And Dr. Davey is the lead on this, so he'll provide us an overview.
Thank you very much. So with regard to complaint 2503, and in meeting with the licensee, she agreed to let me call her Netta during the CBA meeting. So hopefully she'll extend that courtesy to me here as well. But on the 28th of February of this year, the CBA reviewed this complaint. Both the complainants and Ms. Netta were attended. They were both cooperative, answered our questions. At the end of the day, the committee, in reviewing all the documentation related to the complaint, including documentation with regard to policy, procedure, training that Netta and her organization engage in, we can came to the conclusion and make the recommendation to the board to dismiss this case. This recommendation was made unanimously by all members of the CBA.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Any questions for Dr. Davey at this time? Hearing none, I see Ms. Netta and Ms. Stark are here. I thank you for being here. And Ms. Stark, thank you for trying to be in two places at once. We didn't have to clone you yet. So maybe you wish to make a statement or make yourselves available for questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will not make a statement, but we are available for questions if anybody has questions. We obviously agree with the committee's recommendation to dismiss this complaint. Thank you.
Oh, you're muted, Mr. Chair.
Oh, happened a second time. Any questions, discussion, or motion? Dr. Stewart.
If the chair would entertain a motion, a move that we dismiss the complaint.
I'll second.
Okay, motion and a second. Any further discussion? As a discussion matter, I'll just say that the CBA looked at this matter and all of the materials are in the record. And we as the board have reviewed all of those things. And I, for one, concur with the recommendation that we received from the CBA. Okay, so there is a motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Netta, and thank you, Ms. Stark.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, this takes us back to agenda items. 11 and 12 are closely related, so we believe 11 should precede 12 to, you know, to move in that order.
Thank you. Okay, 11 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding application for licensure by waiver with additional FAIR materials submitted by Jennifer Krause, PhD. And Dr. Flint is going to provide us a summary of this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try and keep this brief. I do have additional side notes if any of the members need particular page numbers. This has been seen several times, so it's a little bit lengthy. I will try and just do a summary. Dr. Krause obtained her doctorate degree in counseling from Walden University in 2022. She applied and passed the ECCC through Kentucky, but is not licensed in any state. As far as the application, the references and self-query from the earlier application were still in the date range. Why it's in front of us is that the ARC, the Application Review Committee, continued to have questions despite the really copious amounts of documentation provided, because it was inconsistent and appeared and did not show that this intern was paid for anything other than hours of productivity. Additionally, there's documentation in the training manual that states that Dr. Bushman and Dr. Cuneo were co-responsible for the internship process. We've received multiple different phases of documentation, internal documents stating that in the internship training plan, things like pays varies greatly, but pay is available for client contact hours. A second internship compensation agreement said something different, and then the internship and postdoc training plan also said something different from the two previous documents. Both Dr. Krause and Dr. Bushman testified that they were unaware of the wording, particularly in the internship training plan, and that specifically was the one that had the four contact hour specifier. To show the committee that pay was not based on productivity, Dr. Bushman submitted Word documentation invoices consisting of the time frame of June 21 to May 22, which was the time of the internship. Additional testimony reviewed that payments were made in various forms, some of them corroborated by bank statements, others such as Venmo, PayPal, some from Grandis Health, some in cash, some identified from Dr. Cuneo, et cetera. A comparison of the payments on the bank statements and the payroll invoices provided showed no payments corresponding with the totals provided. The training logs from MediTrack were not accurate per the applicant because of their trimester system and kind of mandating that hours fit within the 11-week periods, leaving out any way for them to insert hours for the 2 weeks in between. Dr. Krause testified that she had to fit them in wherever they could go. The night before the ARC meeting last Friday, several new pieces of information were received from Dr. Krause. They were not reviewed during that committee by Dr. Medina and myself because of the lack of timeliness of the submission. In addition, afterwards, when we went to open those spreadsheets, they were corrupted and or empty and were not able to be reviewed again until, again, last night, just hours before this meeting. As of yesterday, we also received handwritten 1099s that were submitted for a review, which have totals that do not align with the bank statements nor the generated payroll invoices provided by Dr. Bushman for review. A review of the Excel documents that I did this morning was cursory due to the time constraints, but a review of July 2021 alone shows discrepancies again. Payroll invoices say payments of one. If we add that to the hours that supposedly worked, it just continues to not add up. At this point, with the amount of disparity and lack of evidence that Dr. Krause was reimbursed in a way that was not based on client contact hours, we were asking for the full board to review this matter. And I believe this concludes my summary, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. Any questions for Dr. Flint? Okay, hearing none. Dr. Krause, are you present? If so, now would be the time to unmute and make a statement and remain available for questions.
I am present. I know my MediTrack hours weren't going to align with those, and that is what I included with that because of the 11-week term, and we were expected to also work during those 2 weeks in between. And when I got guidance finally from my school supervisor, they just told me to fill them in as I could. And I'm like, this is going to look crazy if anybody ever looks at them. And they do look crazy. I was paid in a variety of different ways. I was paid for all of my hours, sometimes cash, sometimes, you know, I would have, or we would have those e-cards the insurance companies like to pay. And then Dr. Cuneo would run them. And instead of sending the money directly to Dr. Bushman and for him to send it to me, she would send, you know, part of my payment to me. Sometimes it was a check from Dr. Bushman. It wasn't just here at the end of the month, here are my hours, here's a check for that, because sometimes I would want cash or he wouldn't have his checkbook, or, you know, there were various reasons for why those payments were split up. It was fine by me. I didn't have an issue with it. And I did not think that this needed to, I know it looks messy, but I didn't think I was going to ever have to explain it to anybody. I don't know.
Thank you, Dr. Krause, and thank you for all of the information that you have given us so far. And also want to acknowledge that the supervisors have been forthcoming in sharing information with the board on this matter. Any questions for Dr. Krause? Okay, then I think we have Dr. Bushman present. If so, now would be the time to unmute yourself and make a statement.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I would just second what Dr. Krause has said. We, you know, it's a small practice, just her and me. We had different ways that we would reconcile her payment and for the different hours. It wasn't a set time that we would, you know, first of the month, we would do everything. There were different disbursements at different times. As she mentioned before, there were some e-cards that would come into my office that I don't have a credit card reader, and that's the only way that you can cash those. Dr. Cuneo, who previously did some work with me and who was secondary supervisor in this case, I knew that she had a credit card reader. So she's been kind enough to run those and send payments back to me in the interim. But also in this case and back at that time, I would send her these e-cards. She would submit them through whatever her credit card reader was. And then she would send that directly back to Dr. Krause as part of her payment from me. So those payments, even though they may have her name on them, those were coming from my office. And there were reconciliations. We did go through the invoices generated by Dr. Krause. In the previous meeting, I explained that, you know, we would go through what had come in from the e-cards. We would look at different cash disbursements that I had given her, and I would either write a check or do additional cash as the reconciliation. Both Dr. Krause and I are very comfortable using cash, and in many cases prefer that because of different things from our backgrounds, which we can explain later if needed, but cash was a big part of our payment arrangement.
Thank you, Dr. Bushman.
One more point, yeah. You know, if things aren't matching up directly with bank accounts, I think it's important to keep in mind, especially with cash, I think there may have even been one instance where I paid her with a cashier's check because out of necessity. I think it's important that she may not have deposited all that or deposited that all at the same time. You know, bank statements and what people are paid don't always correlate.
So thank you, Dr. Bushman. So my question is, I think the board's job is to find out whether there was payments made or whether there was an expectation that the intern is being paid for being productive, or I can't say productivity as well as Dr. Flynn can. So the way to sort of ascertain that is to look at the payroll records, and because the payroll records are so messy, is there any other document that would either show a steady hourly rate or steady stream of income, or any sort of a written agreement that shows the nature of the payment relationship between the employer and the intern?
So there was a written agreement at the beginning of the internship, signed by her and me, that indicated an hourly rate. That's, contrary to fee for service or productivity. We also, as I mentioned in the previous meeting, I do have copies of those invoices with, the word settled on them whenever we did have a reconciliation, but that was the only record that I kept from those, just that it indicated it was paid. And then, of course, the 1099s. The 1099s bridge 6 months. The internship crossover 2021-2022. I do not believe it's correct, as someone stated in the summary of the case. I do believe that the invoices that were settled and those amounts, that they do correlate with the 1099s. When you add up the 1099s, you add up what those invoices should have been, give or take 1 month, where payments may have come in. We did the reconciliation, a month afterward, whatever. But those are either right on or very close to right on.
Thank you, Dr. Davey.
Thank you. So Dr. Bushman, I think my question is just going to be right to the point. I mean, based on AACR 426-209C, compensation cannot be based on productivity during her internship. Was the compensation based on productivity?
It was not. It was based on hours spent in the practice. And so I previously explained, she got paid for time in supervision. She got paid for time when she was reviewing records or, helping with other different things, doing research for me. I do a lot of forensic cases. So, no, there were many, many tasks. And overall, the understanding was she was being paid hourly and not based on whether or not a check came in for someone that she had seen.
So what you're saying is that there were a series of other activities as part of her internship that would not have been billable to the client or to the payer that she was allowed to engage in?
Yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Thank you, Dr. Bushman, for being here. So my question goes, is about then these transfers from Dr. Cuneo, if she's not paid by productivity and Dr. Cuneo is cashing those checks, why aren't you paying her directly? It would make more sense. Well, number one, it doesn't truly make sense from, again, a business standpoint that another business is cashing your checks, because it shows as income to the other practice, not to you. And I'm not sure that, if you were audited, it would hold that this person is running your payments and then giving you the payment. But then why is Dr. Cuneo paying her when, if it's not based, if it's just based on hours, all payments should be coming from you? And then Dr. Cuneo's, if she's doing you a favor of running these credit card payments, which again, I'm not really even understanding why, because I run payments through my practice and it's really not complicated or cumbersome, but why wouldn't that go to you?
So first of all, I don't have a credit card reader. I never have. My bank has no way of running the paper cards. They say you have to have a physical plastic card to be able to run those. So I did go through the process trying to figure out what I needed to get one. There weren't a whole lot of payers that were doing those. And so it just started out as a convenience with Dr. Cuneo that she was doing them for me so I wouldn't have them lapse. As far as why they were routed to Dr. Krause, I think it was just a matter of convenience. I don't remember exactly what conversations we were having at the time, but we knew this was money that was coming in. I think it's possible, you know, Dr. Krause's bank is back in Illinois. There were delays in cashing checks and when those would get credited. That was part of why we wanted to pay her in cash, but also that these things, if they were coming through, they could get directly credited to her bank account and there wouldn't be any delays. I believe that was part of why we wanted to have that go directly to her. It was just a matter of convenience. In retrospect, yeah, like she said, nobody thought anyone was going to be coming after looking at all of this or trying to make sense of it.
So wouldn't it have been more convenient, though, to still get the payment from you since your agents, your practice is the one employing Dr. Krause, not Dr. Cuneo's? It just seems more cumbersome.
It was actually just a matter of convenience with the financial part, with, again, rate of which she could have that credit to her bank account. As I recall, I mean, this is a long time ago, but as best as I could remember, that was part of the reason. Just a convenience, save a step. Yeah. Other than that, I don't remember. But yes, those payments came from me. They were not from Dr. Krause.
I don't have any further questions, Mr. Diner. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Flint?
Thank you. Just a follow-up question from Dr. Medina's thought process there. So these physical cards would be mailed to your office in Tucson, and then you would send them to an office in Phoenix, Grandis Health, to run through a card reader. Do this type of a process in my office. So I'm literally asking logistics. You're in two different cities.
Yes. So these are paper cards. Sometimes, so it's just a sheet of paper with a virtual card printed on it.
Okay.
And so, yes, as those would come into my office, there was never any physical plastic card.
Okay.
If there were, it would have been problem solved. But because they were paper, I had no way to run them. I would take a picture of them, you know, just get a batch of them, take a picture, send them to her. She would read those off and enter them into her card reader whenever she had time. So sometimes there were intervals, you know, it is a tedious process. So it's part my convenience when I could send things to her, part her convenience when she could run them and she might have been running other batches.
Okay. And just one other question for Dr. Krause. You had mentioned earlier today that you were kind of fine with this arrangement and sometimes cash, sometimes card, sometimes check. Being from the training community, I understand the barely livable wage that our interns are often paid. And I could imagine that it was very difficult for you to live potentially when you never knew when money was coming in. So I want to clarify that you were in understanding that that was how it was going to be and you were truly okay with it, because that sounds rather honestly abusive to a person working in the process of learning and training and trying to get their internship hours.
Yeah, and I can understand that viewpoint. I bartended and waitressed, putting myself through school for the last like 20 years. So having a very varied income is normal for me. It's harder for me to adjust to getting a paycheck once a month than getting paid sporadically, actually, just because my entire adult life has been that way. But on top of that, I did have student loan money that would come in and help me pay with that. So I never really had any major issues for it.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Dr. Seidman?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Diner, and good morning, Dr. Krauss. I appreciate you being here today. And just within that same line of thinking, I can appreciate being a graduate student many, many years ago and being in training and, you know, living on ramen noodles and macaroni and cheese. However, and this is actually directed toward Dr. Bushman, I have a question for you and a comment. Sometimes trainees feel that they cannot say no or this arrangement is not okay based on the power differential. And I think that's one of the things that being a member of the ARC, we're concerned about. And that, regardless of the outcome of today, really needs to be cleaned up if you're going to be continuing to be a supervisor for pre-doctoral and postdoc trainees. The question I had, Dr. Bushman, this is to you, is what, during Dr. Krauss's training with you, what was the relationship between you and Dr. Cuneo, please?
So Dr. Cuneo and I have known each other for a very long time, and we have collaborated as supervisors with different trainees over the years, primarily trainees that came through her facility where she was a primary supervisor, in a couple of cases where I was primary supervisor. So really that relationship, I think we consider each other colleagues. We will call and ask each other questions about different issues that might have come up as far as co-supervision or, you know, just having someone to bounce those things off of. But primarily over the last few years, it's just been the relationship of, say, co-supervisors, where either her internship had people that needed a secondary supervisor or my internship had somebody that needed a secondary supervisor. Again, we've remained collegial through the years. We do talk often. We interact often, but we have separate businesses.
Right. Thank you. And to piggyback on that, so you're not in a consortium, so your practices aren't related in a training consortium. You're separate practices, and one of you is a primary and one is a secondary, and that's in writing. And the trainees that you have are aware of that relationship and the boundaries of that relationship?
So I think the way that it's been set up has been consortium-like. My model for all of this goes way back, almost 20 years, when I came to town and was approached by some people from Walden University to see if I might help supervise them. So it was a learning process. I looked through some other training manuals at that time when I was making sure that we met criterion for the university where, you know, that their requirements were most important because a lot of people were licensing somewhere else. So we had, you know, different boards that they were paying attention to and that we wanted to make sure we met their requirements for. But at that time, there were a lot of consortium type internship arrangements in Arizona. And from what I could gather, they were separate agencies that just agreed to work together so that these interns could have places to learn and get experiences. So, yeah, when we have worked together, we've been a consortium as far as the university goes, and the agreement that we have together is with the university. Typically, Walden University is the one that we've worked together on. That they understand we are in separate places. We are not part of the same business corporate structure, but that we do have some crossover.
And financial arrangements are between, kind of like what you described earlier about payments to interns being done by the other person. That's in writing.
The primary supervisor has been the one responsible for the payment agreements. I don't have anything in writing about payment agreements for Dr. Cuneo's primary supervisory interns. And likewise, my payment agreement is between me and the interns that I primarily supervise.
And what you described earlier was in writing to Dr. Krause when she started her placement with you?
Yes, we had a payment agreement. It's been submitted to the board previously about how she would be paid.
Including Dr. Cuneo paying her at times?
No, it didn't do that because I was responsible for that. The Dr. Cuneo piece is not payment from Dr. Cuneo. That's my money that just happened to come through Dr. Cuneo out of convenience because she had a credit card reader.
Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Dr. Krause, thank you for being here this morning. Dr. Bushman as well, thank you. Question for Dr. Bushman. Given this board's inquiry in this case, and really about practice and fee for service versus stipend, have you considered or have you implemented changes in your practice that make it more streamlined? I mean, this is, I agree with Dr. Flint. This seems, you know, just an unnecessary tangled web here. So has there been any streamlining of your payment considerations?
So I've not had any interns since Dr. Krause. So there hasn't been a need to update that. But yes, definitely through this process, I've had time to consider things. And we'll definitely try and make that easier on whoever the intern is in the future, if in fact I choose to continue doing that.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you. Dr. Flint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up question to Dr. Bushman, please. So when you are a supervisor, you have to have access to the records of the patients being seen because you hold ethical and you hold responsibility for them. Can you tell us how, if Dr. Cuneo is needed to step in on Dr. Krause's cases, i.e. your cases, how did she have access to your documentation and records? And vice versa, if you've had this relationship going different directions over time. Full access to medical records, full knowledge of the patient, contact, emergency, et cetera, et cetera. How did that piece happen?
So I'm not even sure if that ever did happen. I was the case supervisor for any cases that Dr. Krause would have seen. Mm-hmm. So I had those records. I am quite antiquated as far as record keeping. I do a lot of forensic work. So most of my stuff is still hard copy paper files. That's what, if in fact Dr. Cuneo did have any kind of case supervision for Dr. Krause, I expect that it would have been a hard chart with all the hard documents carried back and forth. Dr. Cuneo, on the other hand, does have an EMR that she uses through her practice. There have been cases in the past where I've been the secondary supervisor and I've had access to that. That's easier than carrying the paper chart back and forth for the intern. But that's how we've done it. I don't have an EMR that she accesses. So it would, if she had to do it, it would be paper records.
And were the patients noticed through informed consent that there was a secondary supervisor and that supervisor would have access to their records?
We had notice on the paperwork that, yes, there's the person's an intern, they're under supervision, there are at least two supervisors, and that those records are reviewed. Yes.
And the patients knew that that other supervisor had nothing to do with your company, nothing to do with your clientele, did or didn't have expertise in the area of forensics, but they would be potentially making decisions on your behalf should Dr. Krause need backup support in supervision. Maybe you were unavailable, or am I describing something that had never kind of crossed?
I don't think to that degree that would have been included in any paperwork, but the fact that she was under supervision, had more than one supervisor, you know, as part of the informed consent with her being an intern. We were also selective about the kind of patients that she would have primary responsibility for.
I think Dr. Cuneo does have expertise in the kind of forensic work that you do, though, for the most part, if I'm not wrong.
Yes, I didn't even address that concern. But yes, that is true. Dr. Cuneo does work that is in many, many ways similar to work that I do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think Dr. Davey had your hand up. No?
Okay. No, Dr. Flint got to where I wanted to go, so I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Any further questions for Dr. Krause or Dr. Bushman? Okay, then I think since Dr. Flint was the lead, Dr. Flint, do you want to get us started with our discussion?
I think that I am feeling like the numbers don't add up. There's a whole lot of kind of fill in information that may or may not be happening after the fact based on questions that are being asked rather than having full transparency from the beginning. I have concerns about our intern trainees in our state and how they're treated, and that not having protections as a supervisor are also a concern, that the varied payment at varied times. Dr. Krause has been very kind to say that that was fine with her. But I agree with Dr. Seidman that maybe there's an awareness in the power differential that no one would stand up and say, this is not acceptable to me, because they need their hours for licensure. I'm really concerned about the supervisory practices, and I am not convinced that she was not paid on productivity or by client hours at this point.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I concur with Dr. Flynn's assessment. You know, perhaps intentions were good at the onset of the experience. And, you know, ultimately, I don't think that either Dr. Bushman nor Dr. Krause really paid attention to all the details that needed to go into an experience to make it a valid training experience, internship or postdoc. Ultimately, it is on, you know, the applicant, in this case, the supervisor also got pulled in, to bring in, you know, to show evidence that, yes, this was paid in a way that is congruent with the rules and laws and statutes of our state. And I, in my eyes, that has not happened. I am not convinced that this was not paid based on productivity. And never have I seen someone get paid in this very convoluted matter. And when asked for documentation, I mean, we've tried and tried as a committee, as, you know, professionals in a training position of you know, future professionals in the field to really see, okay, giving that opportunity, show us how this was. And, you know, if this was, you know, we wouldn't have further questions. And I think every time we've been provided with information, we've come up with more questions rather than answers to the questions that we had. So in my view, it has not been shown to us that this was not paid based on productivity. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart, I promise I'll get to you, but my question maybe is for Ms. Campbell or Ms. Galvin. I see you're back. So this matter is licensure by waiver, not licensure by credentials. Does that affect any of the analysis for us?
So this is Jean Galvin, and I apologize for being tardy to this. And I haven't heard the whole discussion. I would ask maybe Heidi or Kathy to help, because I just haven't been privy to everything. I don't think it matters whether it's by waiver or credential, but...
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding that one of the qualifications, one of the criteria that the board is required to substantively evaluate when applying by waiver is the training experience. So the statute, our statutes do provide that, you know, with where other application pathways are concerned, that there's been a process that somebody else has conducted, such as, you know, the credentialing organizations that we recognize, CPQ and so forth. There's an understanding that that evaluation has been conducted. So with where waiver is concerned, though, there's still a statutory responsibility on the part of this board to evaluate all the training experience information, the same way that you would for someone who's applying for approval to take the EPPP and become licensed.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Dunnar. My question was partially answered by your query, and that is the way that item 11 reads is regarding possible action, licensure by waiver with additional FAIR materials. I think that I certainly do not want to penalize the student. I don't want to penalize the trainee. And yet at the same time, I want to hold the supervisors responsible. And I don't know a course of action to thread that needle if possible, or what is available to us to not penalize Dr. Krause in this process. Maybe that's more of a pondering than a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I was thinking along the same lines. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea that, you know, given the imbalance in the power relationship, it shouldn't be like a denial of licensure for Dr. Krause because some of these things weren't under her control. It fell more on the supervisor to make sure that they're complying with our existing laws and regulations. But yeah, it's a complicated thing to sort of evaluate all of that. Dr. Flint.
I'd like to motion to move into executive session for purpose of obtaining legal counsel.
Second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. Okay, we are back in open session. It's 10:55 a.m. We are on number 11. Any further discussion or motion? I know there's going to be discussion. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's not, in my opinion, there's not been adequate proof that Dr. Krause has not met the training requirements. And I certainly in no way want to punish the applicant for something that supervisors may be culpable for, which may be taken up at a later point. But I just don't think we can go to a hearing before a hearing officer and demonstrate that Dr. Krause should not be licensed by waiver. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. As a matter of discussion, I think this is a tough one because I think this board has mulled over this complicated issue on multiple occasions before, and the basic sort of underlying idea behind the regulation that we have is we want to prevent supervisors from having an exploitative relationship financially with the intern. And from today's discussion, I heard that Dr. Krause was truly okay with the financial arrangement that she had with her supervisor, which is Dr. Bushman. So I guess in my mind, the question is, was the internship experience substantively valuable enough that, you know, we can think of this as the financial relationship is messy, but, you know, Dr. Krause was paid hourly or paid as a stipend, given that there's the e-cards and the cash and everything else. And the actual, you know, substance of the internship experience met the minimum standards that we have set as meeting the qualifications necessary for licensure by waiver. And along those lines, I land where Dr. Stewart lands. You know, maybe the payment plan was messy, but it doesn't seem to be there doesn't seem to be evidence that it was paid purely on the basis of productivity. And that would be, at least in my mind, a sufficient basis to grant licensure. But because I guess the alternative is denial of licensure, which truly hurts Dr. Krause's licensure elsewhere, or, you know, even licensure in the future in the state of Arizona. And the third option is possibly, you know, again, depending on which way the board vote goes, would be for Dr. Krause to consider withdrawal of her application for licensure by waiver. That may be sort of, from her perspective, the path of least resistance if the board is inclined to deny the licensure, which truly, you know, hurts the applicant in multiple ways. Maybe I'll stop there. Any further discussion? Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. You know, I agree this is extremely messy in terms of, you know, payment, in terms how hours were recorded. It's deeply concerning that a school, in my opinion, would say we'll just put the hours wherever they fit. That is pretty much telling the applicant to not submit, you know, why would they give them a system that doesn't allow them to record the hours accurately and then tell them put the hours wherever they fit? It just, that is concerning to me. It, you know, everything is very convoluted. I think something that is deeply disturbing is that when we have requested documentation to show, yes, can you show that this wasn't paid based on productivity? I don't think we've been given, you know, something that is congruent with anything else, not the bank statements,
you know, her being paid from another practice that doesn't have anything to do with the practice. So, I don't see how it's not even clear to me how the internship was, or the training experience in general, was paid. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Seidman?
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I agree with a number of my colleagues, what they mentioned. In reviewing all the material and listening to the testimony today from Dr. Krause and Dr. Bushman, it's clearly the documentation part is truly messy. With that said, I don't think we have enough evidence to prove that the internship was paid based on productivity, or that it was paid via stipend and Dr. Krause was paid for all of her hours that she did at Dr. Bushman's placement. So in my opinion, we don't have enough evidence to deny licensure by waiver. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Flint.
This has been one of those really, as other colleagues said, really messy situations. And I also don't want to start the precedence that if you don't have clear documentation, just start throwing everything at the board and we'll still let you get licensed anyway. So I do want to put that on the record. I do not want an applicant ever to be punished because of the processes of the directors or the supervisors. And here we are in this really strange quandary of we can't prove either way, but each way we move, then I just feel like we're setting potential precedents that just throw 7,000 sheets of paper at the board. And I think I've said enough on that. Dr. Medina, sorry.
Thank you.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you. Mr. Diner, yes, I fully agree with Dr. Flint. I think because this is so unique, it sets precedent. And I think Dr. Flint described it accurately. We were just thrown sheet after sheet after sheet that doesn't really answer the question on the first fair, nor the question on the second fair that we issued for this case. And so that would be a big concern of mine, in that we can request documentation. And as long as, you know, applicants throw a bunch of different sheets that show, oh, this came here maybe, or over here, and this doesn't add up, but this is the reason why, that it would be okay and it would lead to licensure. So I agree with Dr. Flint in that statement. Thank you.
Thank you. So let me do this. I know Dr. Davey will get to you. I'll make a motion to open a complaint against Dr. Bushman for the record keeping and documentation issues that we have identified.
Second.
There's a second. Any discussion as to that?
I was getting ready to do the same. I would just add to the discussion there that it's failing to or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, and in this case, and professional records pertaining to the practice of psychology.
Thank you. Dr. Flint?
And I would like to add a friendly amendment to cover the possibility of unprofessional conduct in a relationship with interns that was potentially exploitive in some way.
Thank you. I'll add that to my motion.
I accept that as a second.
And Dr. Flint? Oh, okay. Okay, any for Dr. Medina?
Oh, thank you. I was going to add, but not, it was to my previous, you know what, I'll hold my comment because okay. We're voting on this particular okay. issue. So I'll just share later. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, point of order, should we take the application first before moving into the opening of the complaint? And maybe that's a question for Ms. Galvin.
I don't know if procedurally it makes a difference.
Okay, so there is a motion to open the complaint. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, so now moving back to the matter of granting licensure, denying licensure, or giving Dr. Krauss an opportunity to withdraw. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the chair would entertain a motion, I move that the board approve Dr. Krauss's application for licensure by waiver.
There is a motion. I'll second for purposes of discussion. Dr. Medina.
Yes, and this goes into the comment I was going to make earlier. I do have concerns that the request for further information, the first one issued and the second one issued, I don't think we were provided the information that was requested. And we were just thrown a bunch of documents and things, and that is concerning to me.
So in terms of discussion, I'm prepared to grant licensure today, but I also hear the concerns, and maybe the way to thread that needle is if would the board members be satisfied, again, just thinking out aloud, would the board members be satisfied with maybe a narrative response from Dr. Krauss as to the quality of the internship experience she obtained, and then maybe we can truly evaluate whether the internship benefited Dr. Krauss, and then we can proceed that way. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I absolutely would like to hear from Dr. Krauss regarding her experience, the quality of the experience to prepare her for licensure and practice as a psychologist, if the chair entertains that.
Sure. Okay. Let's get Dr. Krauss, maybe your backup, and if you want to provide a narrative as to the question on the table.
I'm sorry, Dr. Krauss, I don't want to interrupt you. Would the board want to go into executive session for legal advice?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. None opposed, the motion carries. Okay, we are back in open session, 11:27 a.m. I'm just trying to ascertain if we have quorum. Okay, I see all six of us. Okay, we are still on number 11. There is a motion to grant licensure on the table. Dr. Stewart, what's your, it's your call if you want to withdraw the motion or should we run the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to continue with the motion and just get it voted up or down based on the issue as described in number 11. If it's voted down, then we're free to make motions for additional things that have been discussed.
Okay. Ms. Poe, roll call on the motion to grant licensure.
Chairman, Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
No.
Dr. Flint?
No.
Dr. Davey?
No.
Dr. Seidman?
No.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
We've got two yeses, four noes. The motion to grant licensure fails.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Okay, so then is there any discussion or a motion for additional information, potentially? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we direct the board staff to offer an opportunity for a third fair waiver, a waiver by fair to submit evidence as outlined by the board staff and discussed by the board.
Okay, I'll second that for purposes of discussion, but maybe board staff will need more clarification. Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I think, yes, I would like definitely some discussion on this. There were two fares issued, and we did not receive a documentation or evidence to substantiate what we were asking for. And so this is, you know, and perhaps it could be added to the motion, the opportunity for Dr. Krause to withdraw. So either comply with the fare or withdraw the application for licensure, because that we would allow that. You know, ultimately, we do not want to this to be on Dr. Krause's permanent record if it were to be denied. But ultimately, there were fares that were issued that not, in the responses were not done either on a timely manner and did not include the evidence that was requested. So I don't know if that can add some nuance to some other details to that request.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. And if Dr. Krause decides to respond to the, sorry, I'd like to see very specific evidence that Dr. Krause was paid for all of her indirect hours. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
I would like to amend my motion to include the comments by Dr. Medina and Dr. Seidman.
I'll amend my second accordingly. Dr. Medina?
And I just wanted to add that, you know, that includes if you, you know, if it is, you know, what was submitted in the past that you were paid X amount on a particular month, and, it, you know, we need to see where that money came from so that it can account for unbillable, unproductive hours as well. Thanks.
Thank you. So board staff, is that does that clarify the scope of the third fare request?
Mr. Chair, let me make sure that Ms. Folks sees it the same way that I do. I am fine with it, but Ms. Folks, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair, board members, I guess, well, I wasn't in the executive session, so I don't know, but I could talk to Heidi about it and we'll find out. But I'm still puzzled about, I guess it's going to, does the board want anything truly specific? Like, I mean, we've asked for pay stubs, we've asked for, or the committee's asked for a number of different types of documents, and Dr. Bushman and Dr. Krause provided what they could. I'm not sure if there's, is there anything else specific to put in the fare is the question.
Dr. Flint?
As ARC chair, would it be appropriate for me to work with Kathy and kind of do a bit of analysis about side by side what has been presented and what the exact questions still remain are in those inconsistencies? Would that be a helpful pathway forward?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Flint, that would be extremely helpful. Thank you.
Great. Dr. Seidman?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I just have a quick comment. I want the audience to be aware that it's up to the applicant to prove that they're eligible for licensure. And Dr. Flint, I appreciate you needing more work. In my opinion, I believe it's up to Dr. Krause to prove that, Dr. Krause and her supervisors. So I know the ARC works extremely hard to do what they do to grant application, licensure for application. I just think it's up to the applicant to work as hard, or if not harder.
Okay, there is a motion on the table for additional information. So that essentially tables the consideration of the licensure application until such time that we obtain the information that is requested. I don't think we need a roll call for this. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries.
And excuse me, Mr. Diner, that included the option to withdraw the application if Dr. Yes. Krause chooses to do so. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is ZD. ZD. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to exercise my privilege to take a comfort break of 5 minutes. We'll be back at 11:40. Yes.
Since it's 11:41, I know we are looking at, the agenda item 12. Thank you. That, because of the relationship of 11 and 12, but I'm looking at agenda item 18, and I think that we want to at least make sure that 18A is addressed. 18C can wait till April. I think the board should make an effort to try to do 18A and B is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I appreciate that. For the record, we might lose quorum at 1 o'clock, and I would be the culprit because I have a hard stop at 1. So let's try to get through as many items as possible. Number 12 is, let me pull it up, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case review of complaint number 25-15 against Jody Cuneo, PhD. And Dr. Seidman is the lead. The floor is yours, Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Dr. Jody Cuneo was issued licensure by the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners in 2017 and is the sole owner and director of Grandis Health, an agency that provides internship and postdoctoral supervised experience for psychologist trainees. As the board may recall, Dr. Julie Curley, who was a past applicant for licensure, had graduated from Walden University and completed her internship under Dr. Cuneo in August of 2022. Dr. Curley also completed a postdoctoral training experience under Dr. Cuneo's supervision. And of note, the start date had never been verified in the multiple iterations of the documentation that Dr. Curley had presented with Dr. Cuneo. At the board's September 6, 2024 meeting, we reviewed and approved Dr. Curley's request to withdraw her application for licensure due to the internship that they had experienced under Dr. Cuneo's supervision that failed to comply with statutory and rule requirements for licensure. At that time, the board also opened a complaint against Dr. Cuneo regarding various concerns relative to the internship training program. During two ARC meetings where we substantially reviewed Dr. Curley's application materials, we identified that the training experience was compensated for Dr. Curley's productivity, which is inconsistent with R426209 supervision requirements and compensation for interns. During the ARC's July 26, 2024 meeting, Dr. Cuneo stated, quote, "The trainee's pay structure was not a standard flat stipend, but was going to vary by the amount of client contact hours." Both Dr. Curley and Dr. Cuneo attended the August 24th board meeting. And Dr. Cuneo stated to the board that Grandis Health trainees are not compensated based on hours worked, direct client contact hours, or productivity. The board requested Dr. Cuneo submit copies of pay stubs, timesheets, and other documentation that reflected the compensation arrangement during Dr. Curley's training experience. At the August 24th Application Review Committee meeting, Dr. Curley stated clearly that she was paid for each hour she was with a client and was not compensated for the hours, for other hours, including Dr. Cuneo's supervision provision. Dr. Curley confirmed that pay stubs were never issued to her and that she wasn't always paid on time. Other interns also had the same experience. She also read a text to us sent by Dr. Cuneo that stated, if the checks go through, then yes, I can pay you. During the application review committee process, Dr. Cuneo submitted 7 different versions of Dr. Curley's internship verification forms. They had different start and end dates and hours accrued. Dr. Cuneo also stated, quote, to the question, did the psychology training program have at least 2 psychologists on staff at supervisors, where she stated yes. On September 13th, 2024, Dr. Cuneo was notified by the field placement coordinator at Walden University that a current intern was being removed from the internship placement at Grandis Health, given the board's investigation. There are other concerns about Dr. Cuneo's training program. Dr. Cuneo has reported to board staff that, quote, there were no other contracted psychologists with Grandis Health who have provided supervisory experiences at any point with any interns. Any secondary or outside supervisors would have separate contracts between the interns, those potential supervisors, and their schools. Dr. Curley's records noted that a number of her internship hours were acquired under the supervision of Dr. Bushman, who we heard from earlier today. On the internship verification forms Dr. Cuneo submitted in support of Dr. Curley's application, she answered yes to this question. Did the psychology training program have at least 2 psychologists on staff as supervisors? ARS 322071F2 states that the internship training program provides at least 2 psychologists on staff as supervisors, at least one of whom is licensed or certified to practice psychology. At another time, Dr. Cuneo stated, quote, Dr. Benjamin Bushman is not an employee or a contractor associated with Grandis Health, and goes on with some other information about Dr. Bushman. Board staff contacted Dr. Bushman to obtain clarity relative to his role in Dr. Curley's internship. And Dr. Bushman was asked, was there a formal or informal agreement between you and Dr. Cuneo specific to providing internship supervision of Dr. Curley? Dr. Bushman answered, yes, an informal agreement to be available if needed as needed. Another concern was at the January 22nd complaint screening committee. At least one of Dr. Cuneo's former interns attended that meeting, and that person was removed from the internship training program at Grandis Health in September of 2024 by Walden University. In response to questions posed by the complaint screening committee, Dr. Cuneo incorrectly asserted that that person would be able to use the hours accrued at Grandis Health when applying for licensure in the future. This former intern contacted board staff to clarify that issue and noted, quote, while at Dr. Cuneo's site, I logged 1,085 hours in the Meditrek management system with no pay, compensation, or stipend. I understand that none of these are invalid hours, and I am currently starting over with new hours being logged at another site. To clarify, Walden University did not allow me to retain my hours. I lost hours accumulated throughout the 4 terms and started over with an internship. Additionally, I never received any stipend the entire time. That concludes my summary of this particular complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Any questions for Dr. Seidman? Hearing none, I see Dr. Cuneo is present with her attorney, Mr. Beardsley. Thank you both for being here. The floor is yours, a statement, or be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My client is prepared to make a statement. I've only recently been retained. Our firm has only recently been retained, and we communicated with Ms. Michelson that we were seeking a continuance so that Dr. Cuneo could avail herself of the benefit of counsel. We have not had an opportunity to get up to speed. I know there's been voluminous productions and a long history. We've not had an opportunity to get up to speed. It's our hope that if granted a continuance to provide a supplemental response, that we could provide clarity on some of the questions that I noted the board had in the previous matter. So we've requested a continuance of this matter and consideration of this matter so that we could address whatever outstanding and the issues that were just raised by Dr. Seidman.
Thank you. Board members and Ms. Galvin, there is a request for continuance. We have the option of accepting or rejecting that request, but let's do that first and then we can move on.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I apologize for interjecting. I expect that there might be some question over Dr. Cuneo's diligence in securing counsel and why you're receiving this. Seemingly, what is the 11th hour before her hearing? There was a coverage dispute whether or not Dr. Cuneo's claim for representation was covered under her malpractice insurance. That coverage dispute took several weeks. This complaint was opened on January 22nd, 2025, based on the records I've received. That coverage dispute was not finalized until the 4th of February. Within a few days after recovering from some illness, Dr. Cuneo reached out to our office and representation was secured as of the 18th. And shortly thereafter, we reached out to the board to request additional time to provide supplemental response on Dr. Cuneo's behalf. So I mention all that history just because I expect that there's some perception that she wasn't timely in securing counsel. And I think that history demonstrates that she was. She was just dealing with a coverage dispute.
Mr. Chair, can I provide some clarifying details about the timeline?
Sure.
Dr. Cuneo was actually notified of the complaint opening back in September. I did email the complaint notice to her on September 12th of 2024. That notice did indicate she had the opportunity to obtain legal representation. And subsequently, the complaint screening committee reviewed this complaint at their January meeting. She was again notice of her opportunity to obtain representation. I believe that meeting was on January 20th. On that same date, the committee, of course, had decided to forward the complaint to the board for further review. So just to clarify, on January 20th is when I notified Dr. Cuneo of today's meeting date. So that was over, I believe, 40-something days in advance. So I just wanted to note for the record that she's been aware of this complaint since September. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the additional context of the timing from both Mr. Beardsley and Ms. Michelson. So board members, is there a discussion or a motion regarding the continuance request? Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Is it appropriate for me to ask a question directly to Dr. Cuneo?
Sure.
So Dr. Cuneo, are you involved with any trainees at the current time?
No.
Thank you.
Okay, discussion or motion? Dr. Flint.
Sorry, a very quick follow-up to Dr. Seidman's question, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Dr. Cuneo, do you have plans to supervise anybody in the near future? Have you signed a contract with any future supervisees?
No, and none in the extended future either.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Dr. Cuneo was notified of this complaint opened in September. And so, in my eyes, there has been plenty of time to secure counsel from September to here. That's, 6 months? That is my discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we allow a continuance for legal counsel to come up to speed.
Second that.
Second by Dr. Davey. Any further discussion?
And my discussion point just for that, Mr. Chair, would be that if there was an issue with struggling to be able to understand how to obtain counsel through the malpractice or through their insurance process, that that could have delayed some time. Granted that we also let them know in September, that could be an arduous process. And I would just soon, if we're going to hear this matter, make sure that the representation is in place, given the luminous issues that we have to address with the licensee.
And as a matter of discussion, at least like my general understanding is we don't give continuances just on the basis that, you know, a counsel was retained fairly recent in time to the hearing at the complaint screening committee or at the board level. But I think there are extenuating circumstances here. You know, Dr. Cuneo did attempt to secure counsel. Yeah, and it took some process to clear up the insurance and, you know, what the payment plan is for paying the retained counsel. So I'm inclined to grant a continuance just on that basis. And today we also heard, based on questioning, that there is no current intern or a future intern that might be impacted by any decision we make. So there isn't the kind of urgency that we usually have in protecting the public in this particular situation. Any further discussion? Okay, motion to continue. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Cuneo, and thank you, Mr. Beardsley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your consideration, Board.
Okay, let's go to number 18. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding psychologist applications. 18A is Marisa Mascoro, PsyD, approval of supervised experience for licensure. And Dr. Flint, the floor is yours.
I would just like to note I'm abstaining from vote on this case.
Okay.
I have the...
Yes, Dr. Medina, you have the con. Yes, sorry.
Okay. Let's see. Did Dr. Marisa Mascoro had previously applied for EPPP only, and she obtained a passing score in January of 2025. So Dr. Mascoro graduated from Midwestern University in August of 2024 and completed her internship at the Arizona State Hospital for a total of 2,030 hours. She submitted pre-internship hours as follows: 660 hours from the Arizona State Prison Complex, and those hours met our criteria for licensure. There were 305 direct hours and 66 hours of supervision. And then she submitted 667 hours from the Arizona Neurology Associates, with 435 of those being direct and 73 hours of supervisions. The references and self-query were all submitted, and I have no concerns with this application.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Any discussion or motion? Excuse me.
I move that we approve her hours and request for licensure.
Second.
Second by Dr. Seidman. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Congratulations, Dr. Mascoro. Okay, 18C. Is Joanne Choi, PsyD, request to withdraw licensure by waiver application. And Dr. Flint will provide us a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Joanne Choi obtained her doctoral degree in applied clinical psychology from Chicago School of Professional Psychology, Anaheim, on August 27, 2023. She is licensed in California since 12/31/24 with no actions. Her declaration and attestation statements were completed. Since the program was not APA accredited, the core program requirements form was submitted but had multiple deficiencies. And upon further investigation, the website for the program itself stated that the program was not licensable in Arizona, among many other states, due to its failure to meet the educational requirements of the state. This application falls short of what's needed for licensure in Arizona. We discussed these issues with Dr. Choi, who was in attendance at that ARC meeting. And based on this information, I move to regretfully accept her request for withdrawal of her application for licensure based on it, the educational requirements not meeting that required in Arizona.
Second.
Second by Dr. Stewart. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, let's do B. 18B is Tammy Ricci, PsyD, re-app examined licensure with accommodations. Dr. Flynn, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Dr. Ricci was before the ARC for a sixth attempt at the EPP with testing accommodations request. Dr. Ricci obtained her doctoral degree in clinical psychology from California Southern University. She did submit a new study plan noting the use of a one-to-one tutor. There were two current references and an updated self-query form in her application, as well as a copy of her fingerprint clearance card, which is a new process. So thank you, Dr. Ricci, for adhering to that and submitting it. The hours were all verified at reviews, allowing the EPPP approval prior. We did have accommodations request of a reader, and ASPPP did verify that that was an option. We're a little bit unclear, and I'll ask Dr. Ricci in just a moment to make sure that it's not a reader and a recorder, because that part was not clear to me. The committee had a concern about communications that Dr. Ricci was using in identifying herself as a forensic and clinical psychologist on her email signature line. So those were basically the questions that ARC still had and wanted the full board's opinion, considering the number of attempts, the accommodations request, and also weighing in on the signature line.
Thank you. Dr. Ricci, I see you're here. Now would be the time to unmute yourself. You can make a statement and then we'll have questions.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, I had a stroke and I was having a little, obviously, trouble getting through the EPPP. And so I've been working with a neuroscientist that is trying to help me.
Mr. Chair, if I could just remind Ms. Ricci that she does not need to discuss any medical conditions or diagnoses in open session. That if she wishes to do so, we can do that in executive session.
Oh, I apologize.
That's just a friendly reminder to you.
Okay, thank you. And, but I have been working to get he's been helping me with the critical thinking part again. I'm hoping, you know, this will be the last time if you guys do grant me that request to retake it.
Any questions for Dr. Ricci? Dr. Flint.
Dr. Ricci, thank you for being here. The question about the accommodations request, was it a reader and recorder or just reader?
It was just a reader.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Hi, Ms. Ricci. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being here. I just had a quick question. So today's March 7th, and looking at your training plan, I think you've completed the training plan. So I'm just curious of where you are right now in terms of your confidence, in terms of passing the exam.
Oh, doctor, I think it's definitely been shaky. But working with Dr. Petrocki, we're focusing on the questions. I think I was having trouble determining certain things about it. So he makes me examples, test. And so I do a lot of testing with them and focus on the critical aspect instead of just, I'm very black and white now. And if I don't understand the question, and I think that's why I was failing it repeatedly. So I'm hoping now with working with him that I feel a lot more confident to pass it this time. I pray, you know, if it works out.
Good. His letter stated such. So that's terrific. And we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much. And I notice I did have my mentor, Dr. Fisher, also correct me on writing psychologist. She said, until I'm licensed, that I can't, I have to put just PsyD, I believe, on my emails. And I apologize. I will fix that immediately.
Any questions, discussion, or motion? Yes, Dr. Flint.
Thank you. You were, I couldn't get my hand up fast enough. Sorry about that. I would like to move to put forward an approval for Dr. Ricci with our vote of support and hopefulness that she will this time conquer the exam to be allowed to sit for that.
Second by Dr. Medina. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. Motion passes. Good luck, Dr. Ricci.
Thank you. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, I almost overlooked number 17. That's a renewal application, so we need the board to act on that also, given the timeframes that you must adhere to in the process.
Very good. 17 is discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to renewal application submitted by Demetria Brown, PsyD. Ms. Poe, will you please provide us a summary?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the board office received Dr. Brown's inactive license renewal application, in which she answered yes to the following question, number 9. Since the last license period, have you been or are you currently the subject of any investigation by a regulatory agency licensing board involving allegations of unprofessional conduct, including ethical violations, the provision of psychological services, or financial improprieties? She answered yes to this question, and she provided supporting documentation pertaining to 2 pending complaints that were filed by the same individual with the Virginia Board of Psychology, where she holds an active psychologist license. At the request of the board, Dr. Brown submitted copies of all of the correspondence she's received from the Virginia board, which board members have been provided copies of. Board staff is requesting direction from the board on how to proceed with the inactive license renewal application and if additional action is necessary. At this time, both complaints are still pending with the Virginia Board of Psychology. And that completes my summary of the matter. Dr. Brown is present. I'm not sure she would like to make a statement or just be available for board member questions.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Any questions for Ms. Poe at this time? Hearing none, I see Dr. Brown, you're here. Thank you for being here. You may wish to make a statement and then we'll have questions.
She is not on mute, but maybe she has stepped away from the meeting.
Yeah, I think Dr. Brown is attempting to make contact.
Hello? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I work in a forensic environment. I work with sexually violent predators. And sometimes it can be very litigious. We have complaints against our license. This one has been going on for a while, and it's my understanding that it's been given low priority, I guess because of the nature of it and other complaints that they have to address more immediately. So therefore, I was just informed last week that it's going to go before the board, and hopefully we'll have a decision soon. But I can't really imagine anything happening, because from the information that was submitted and the complaint that was made, what he stated occurred did not occur. And so I have the transcripts if the board wants those for review. But I'm just waiting on a decision.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Brown? Any discussion or motion, board members? So as a matter of discussion, I mean, there's a complaint pending in Virginia based on the records, and it will go through their normal process. But the question for us is whether to grant the renewal application.
So, Mr. Chair,
Dr. Davey,
I would think that it's appropriate for us to grant the renewal, and I can make that a motion. I think part of the discussion would be that Ms. Brown, Dr. Brown, keep us informed as the matter is progressing through the other board as to what happens. I appreciate her position and what she does, and I see no reason for us to delay this renewal. In fact, that we, I think it's incumbent upon us to make that happen.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Dr. Medina.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Davey. I was just going to ask board staff what has traditionally been done in cases like this. I don't recall.
That's kind of set it up. Dr. Medina was with it. They would continue to keep us updated as what was apprised of the situation.
Thank you.
Okay, there's a motion to grant renewal. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Good luck, Dr. Brown, and keep us informed. Yeah. Dr. Davey.
No, that's
okay. Where to next, Ms. Pakkanen?
Mr. Chair, item 14 does also have sort of a time-specific element to it, so I think we need to move to 14.
Okay. 14 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding fee waiver request submitted by RAMP participant 2025-02. Just as a preliminary thing, please don't mention the RAMP participant's name because that's confidential. It's in our material, so board members, it might slip out, so please keep that in mind. Ms. Pakkanen, do you want to provide us an overview?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to. In this instance, the RAMP participant first became known to us in October of 2020. In point of fact, before the RAMP, the Confidential Rehabilitation Monitoring Program, was established by the board. The licensee at that time agreed, was willing to place her license on inactive status, given the information that the board has reviewed in association with her case. And so in two renewal cycles in March of 21 and again in March of 2023, she renewed her license on inactive status and in the process paid the requisite fee of $85 on each occasion. In 2024, late summer of 2024, as the RAMP participant was hoping to transition back to practice and hoping to be admitted to RAMP, she reinstated her license. That was August 29 of 2024. And in doing so, she paid the fee that was required for reactivation of $500. And so the board formally admitted the licensee to the RAMP program in early February. As it happens, her renewal deadline is March 31st of 2025. And it is based on this history that the RAMP participant is coming forward to the board and requesting that the board waive the renewal fee. What I've attempted to do is to help inform the board's discussion, supply the board with the statutory authority that that staff could find specific to this type of a request. And so the statute ARS 32-2067 subsection C prescribes very narrow and specific instance where a license renewal fee may be returned. That's not a waiver, that's a return. And then also the language of ARS 32-2073 subsection G is invoked here. And it's really the language toward the end of that lengthy subsection. A psychologist may request voluntary inactive status by submitting to the board an application and an affirmation that the psychologist shall not practice as a psychologist in the state for the duration of the voluntary inactive status and paying the required fee. I could not find any other language for the board to turn to. Ms. Galvin, I think, is in a much better position than me, however, to provide the board with legal advice where this request is concerned. If you have questions for me, I will answer them for you. I see that the practice partner, Robert Beardsley, for the RAP participants attorney is present, and we may want Mr. Beardsley to have be presented with an opportunity to weigh in as well.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. Questions for Ms. Pakkanen at this time? Hearing none, we'll hear from you, Mr. Beardsley. You're going strong today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have nothing to add to the succinct but accurate history that Ms. Pakkanen just provided. I'm available for questions, but I don't have anything to add to that history. That is the basis of the request, basically that she had just paid $500 and is trying to avoid paying another $500. However the board is able to accomplish that would be appreciated.
Thank you. Ms. Pakkanen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is sort of, you know, splitting hairs to a necessary degree. In point of fact, anyone who is conducting a transaction related to an application for initial licensure, for renewal of licensure, that has to happen within our portal. And the portal requires payment at the end of the process as the final step of the process in order for the application to be submitted. So the question was to waive the fee. I don't see a way to accomplish that. A refund is a different discussion. There are mechanisms to refund fees after they are paid under certain for certain reasons, well documented and supported, of course.
So the question maybe for Ms. Galvin is, I'm reading subsection G and it feels like and paying the required fee is just a requirement we can't switch off or waive, but I would appreciate your thoughts on that.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Someone speaking.
I was just saying you were muted when you were starting.
No, I was gathering my thoughts, but thank you. I'm not sure I understand the question, but she or the RAMP participant is allowed to request that waiver. But as Heidi stated, it's more of a refund than it is a waiver because of the system structure.
Okay, no, that's helpful. So the request is for a refund, not a waiver. Yeah, that's correct. That's a helpful clarification. Thank you. Okay, board members, discussion or a motion?
I just had, Mr. Chair, I just had one further question.
Sure.
This, Ms. Pakkanen, maybe you can walk me through this. Is this just strictly a timing issue? Like, had this, I mean, I understand this is a RAMP participant. We appreciate those that are in the RAMP situation, but if not in the RAMP program, would these fees have been would these fees have made more sense? Like, would these be the actual course of someone who was going through a license renewal or renewal application or renewal fee process?
Mr. Chair, that's I think an insightful question, Dr. Davey. It does seem to be entirely a matter of timing. So whether the renewal deadline was, it could have been February 28th, right? It happens to be March 31. It could have been April 30th. So timing and circumstances as they are, this is where this matter happened to fall, you know, on the calendar and time continuum. So board staff sees it that way. Whether there aren't additional, you know, considerations or nuances that the board may discover in your deliberations, of course you may, but, you know, we see this as this is the statute requires that we structure when renewal deadlines are determined. And so we comply with those and our system complies with those.
Thank you for that. That's helpful. I was just trying to understand, like, I see this as a timing issue. I understand that it's a lot of money back to back, but this to me seems to just be the proper course. Thank you.
Dr. Flint.
I just have a procedural question. Since it's agendized only as a decision regarding a fee waiver, are we able to discuss it in a refund setting?
Yes, that does not concern me.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll make a motion and see where it goes. So my motion is to deny the request for a fee refund. Is there a second?
I'll second.
And my reason is, it's just a matter of timing, but there is a statutory fee that is attached to these applications. And the board, in the exercise of its discretion, I think if we start doing fee waivers or fee refunds, then, it's hard to contain that situation. So as a sort of like a policy matter, at least my general understanding is that fee waivers, or at least I do not think of fee waivers as particularly problematic when we deny them. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Beardsley.
Thank you, board members. Have a good weekend.
Where to next, Ms. Pakkanen?
Mr. Chair, I think the board needs to apply its discretion at this point, and I'll try to, you know, provide some insights and guidance in this process. Item 15 is an item that doesn't need to be heard today. It can be shifted to April. It does not, it's not, you know, consequential in terms of, you know, protecting the public. So I could cover it if you want me to in the time that we have left, or you may elect to continue it. With respect to item 19, that of course is the discussion and update around pending legislation. I can either address that now, or I can supply the board with, you know, some succinct bullet points, some information and updates as a follow-up if we decide that we don't want to conduct this review at this board meeting. So I'm prepared to send that information to the board this afternoon. So what that leaves is item number 16. There are, you know, there's 35 minutes left in the meeting. And so does the board have, you know, thoughts in terms of starting this agenda item, but potentially needing to finish it? Is it practically speaking, can you do this agenda item? Can you consider it thoroughly in the time that we have left? So I think I need the board to make that decision, but those are my insights.
Thank you. I think, I mean, Suspensions are major events in anybody's life, and I would not want to sort of like, have a very truncated or quick discussion about that. But board members, what's your desire in terms of 16? Because we can do 15 and then adjourn the meeting, and then 16 can be in a future meeting. Dr. Medina.
I do think that we would need more time, ample time for discussion. And I, perhaps because it's a serious matter, it's going to go over and it would be a broken up discussion. So yeah. My preference is to have the entire discussion in the same meeting. Thank you.
Dr. Flint.
I agree with my colleague, Dr. Medina, and I would also like to have Dr. Merkin be able to be present, which I understand she cannot be today. So that's just another vote for that delay.
Okay. I'm not hearing a pushback, so maybe I can exercise my privilege. Dr. Stewart, I don't know what you're going to say, but let's go to 15 and finish 15. I know, Mr. Turk, I've seen you being present. I do appreciate your diligence and being present. You're muted, Mr. Turk.
Mr. Chair, what number is this?
This is 16. I believe Mr. Turk is representing Dr. Merkin.
Oh, yeah, we can't hear him. And Mrs. Poe has her hand.
Yeah, Chairman and members of the board, I'm just giving out the next CE code word for those attending. The next CE code word is Rotini. Rotini, thank you.
All right. Okay, well.
If I may, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
I did want to make it clear that Dr. Merkin is here with me. She's just not on camera at the moment.
Okay.
If that makes any difference.
But I think, in exercising our discretion, we do want to have a fuller discussion with Dr. Merkin. I do appreciate her presence and your presence, Mr. Mm-hmm. Turk. But in the interest of time management, some items have to be tabled for a future meeting, unfortunately. So thank you for your understanding. And let's go to number 15, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding telehealth registry annual update and report. I've said this before, so the table matter is open. Number 15, Ms. Pakkanen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We remember it clearly. This matter is coming essentially back to the board in September of 2023. Tatiana Del Toro, behavior analyst, was granted a telehealth registry practice authorization. There was considerable conversation between her and me as that as her annual reporting deadline was approaching and after it passed, relative to, her interest in possibly relinquishing the authorization, maybe keeping it and so forth. I won't go into that history because I think it was, very, it was explored very extensively when you saw this matter previously. At any rate, on January 10th, you told Ms. Del Toro, who was present for this discussion, that the matter of whether to approve her request to relinquish this authorization would be predicated on her compliance with her then overdue annual reporting form submission. So Ms. Del Toro did proceed with submitting the materials and information updates as required by the annual update. In the process, the more communications between her and I were exchanged. But as far as I'm concerned, she met the requirement. She fulfilled the reporting responsibility timely. What I'm doing today is I'm presenting to the board the substance of that annual report. And the board would then, if they find that report, the contents of that report acceptable, if they find her to now be in compliance, the board then may consider the action to take
with respect to the relinquishment of this authorization. And I know there's, you know, a lot of confusing history here, particularly as reflected in the communications between Ms. Del Toro and me. So I will nonetheless do my best to answer any questions. You know, I do think that, you know, one of the issues that the board should sort of look at, again, is the substance of her patient, what she explained that her patient or client contact amounted to during apparently the very limited time and instances that she actually provided telehealth services remotely into Arizona. And that's probably, those questions are probably best directed to Dr. Davey as the LBA expert on the board.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. Any questions, discussion on the report that was submitted? So I saw the report, and as board members might recall it from previous discussions, it's a standard form that they have to fill online. Our board staff does a good job of obtaining required information with specific and directed questions on that standard form. And I think the report is acceptable. That was the only hang up. Dr. Davey?
Yeah, acceptable. I would say this is the bare minimum. And quite honestly, like I, you know, two sentences on what the encounters were, supervision and parent training, leaves a lot to be desired. I'm not super thrilled with this report, to say the least. But a small number of patients, 4, total number of encounters, 20. So a limited number. So I'm not willing to hang this up. But I do take issue with the fact that this was done timely. This has now come to us twice. We've had to redirect this individual in this manner. She failed to file it on time. So at a minimum, as we accept this, I would also like to include the fact that we direct board staff to alert the BACB that this individual has not been in compliance with their own ethics code, which is to respond to licensing bodies and jurisdictions in a timely fashion with regard to their obligations.
So is that a motion, Dr. Davey?
Yeah, I guess a double motion, accept and then refer to the BACB. And Heidi, I'm happy to help you with the ethics code on that, but I think you know that one fairly well.
Okay, I'll second it. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. So then the next motion would be to accept the request of relinquishment of the telehealth registry.
So do we do? Yes, so moved.
Yeah.
Okay. Second.
So motion by Dr. Davey, Dr. Stewart seconds. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, so then let's finish out the legislative update and then we'll call it a day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Turk. Yeah, I'll allow it. It's kind of unusual, but go ahead.
Thank you. I understand the board's, Dr. Merkin understands the board's hesitancy to try to move forward with it, but as you know, she's currently not able to work. She has no income coming in, and she has asked me to ask the board, given her financial matters, if there's any way that the board can consider her matter today or before April.
Unfortunately not, Mr. Turk. I understand the conundrum there, but, you know, here's where we are. But I do appreciate you speaking up about that.
Mr.
Okay, number...
We can schedule this for April as a timed item, if that is, you know, the board's preference.
Sure, yeah, that would be an elegant solution to that. Okay, so number 19 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding financial year 2025 executive budget recommendation and proposed legislation, including but not limited to House bills and Senate bills as listed on the agenda. Ms. Pakkinen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you heard me state earlier, I don't have any clarity relative to the fiscal 2026 budget yet. The legislature has not revealed or indicated that budget negotiations are, you know, going in any particular direction. And I think in the case of I wish we were still 90-10s, the 85-15s, usually I think we're, our considerations are sort of chinked in after the big decisions are made. So I don't have really any update there, but I will speak to, I'll carefully curate from the list of bills what I think the board should know today. I'm going to start with the bill that I think we're watching most closely, which is the...
Ms. Pakkinen, before you go to the bill, just a comment. Maybe this is too undiplomatic, but my understanding is there has been a staff turnover in the legislature, and these were members of the staff that have been guiding the legislators for many, many years. And some of that is in relation to the funding sweep that happened. But there has been a concept floating around of a reverse sweep. So if the legislature can sweep 9-10 board's funds, it can sweep the general fund to maintain the essential services of the 9-10 boards. So I just wanted to mention that on the record in the open meeting, just in case, you know, that helps you negotiate with any current members of the legislative staff.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Yes, I've framed that very speculatively in the past as, you know, might there ever be any interest to make restitution to the boards when funds are ever swept? And there's no history of that. So it's interesting that, you know, that this topic is at least being considered on some level. In past events, I don't think it was ever on anyone's radar that I could tell anyway. So, something, of course, I will monitor very closely and, investigate further. So, in terms of House Bill 2027, the Independent Behavior Analyst Board bill, it is stuck, and in an unfortunate position. I have a statement that I will read virtually verbatim from the lobbyists for AZ ABBA, from specifically from Brandy Patrone. It's being held by the chairman of the Rules Committee because of the perception that the bill creates more government, even though the testimony has established that the opposite is true. Nonetheless, the chair of that committee is considering a compromise, which would be to create statute language by which the board delegates to the Behavior Analyst Committee all regulatory decisions of behavior analysts. This is similar to some boards that have delegated certain authorities to executive directors. So I don't know of any other model like this that exists, but this is the potential compromise, the idea that has been conceived, and the group, you know, advocating for the bill, they're waiting to hear if this compromise might be palatable to Representative Hendricks, who is the chair of the Rules Committee. The bill must move over to the Senate by the 28th of this month. So there isn't an extreme sense of urgency. But of course, you know, the longer that the bill is sort of stuck where it is, the more concern that it creates. And I don't know exactly where, you know, the crafting of the amendment, where that language lies. So that's the best update that I have for the board.
So several of the bills have dropped off, at least for today's purposes anyway. They are, because they didn't get the hearing in the Chamber of Introduction in time, anything that strike through, it seems to be dead unless it emerges in some other capacity, such as, you know, in a strike everything bill. But generally, that's rare. If they're not heard by a committee, it would seem that the committee's leadership at any rate doesn't have the interest in hearing it. So reviving them seem unlikely. With respect to House Bill 2173, this will compel licensing boards to modify the question that they pose on applications relative to a mental health diagnosis or treatment. And so this bill is moving, I think, with enough support that I see the potential that it will reach Governor Hobbs. At least it passed the House on a vote of 34 to 25. And I see that it has been assigned just a few days ago to the Senate committee that will hear it now. Scrolling ahead to House Bill 2441, that is the bill that would compel this board to supply to the party that filed a complaint copies of all documents received, except for those that are restricted under state or federal law. That bill has passed out of the House on a vote of 33 to 27. And so it's crossed over and it will soon be heard in Senate committee. Oh, I saw Dr. Medina's hand up. Oh, okay.
Sorry, Ms. Mackinnon, it's going crazy. It raises its hand by itself. I don't know what's happening. So there's nothing I need to add. Thank you. Just listening to you.
So if you happen to be a member of a cultural group who is effusive with your hand gestures when you talk, this is what's going to happen. I get it. I'm going to skip over a few others just, you know, in the interest of time. I want to go to a new bill, House Bill 2874, Excessive Health Insurance Claims Notification. This bill requires health and disability insurers to notify the Department of Insurance and financial institutions known as DIFI and the appropriate licensing board when in their review of billing records, they detect that a healthcare provider is submitting what would amount to an excessive number of claims, you know, beyond that which is reasonable for any, you know, a period of a workday. In my mind, I question whether this bill is absolutely necessary, and maybe I'm misguided, but I would think this would happen anyway. I would think that referral would come to the board. I think about specifically behavior analyst complaints that have come to the board where these kinds of patterns have been detected. And so that's how we learned about it. But maybe this bill is necessary in a broader sense. So it is moving. It still needs to move, though, to a floor vote. It was introduced a bit late in the House toward the end of the queue, if you will. Let's see. Senate Bill, 1037. This is the one that caps the fund that health boards may, this establishes the ceiling or caps where our funds are permitted to grow. And this bill is moving with strong support. It easily passed the Senate, and I believe it's being heard next week, Wednesday, maybe in its first committee in the House. So this one I see as it could likely reach Governor Hobbs unless, you know, some new fact or discovery somehow derails it in the House. Senate Bill 1125, Psychologist Prescribing Authority.
This passed again with strong support in the chamber of introduction, the Senate, 22-7. It is obviously then receiving bipartisan support. I believe this is being heard in committee also the middle of next week. RO, Regulatory Oversight Committee Chair, Representative Blackmun, called me yesterday to discuss this bill, really wanting to know if the board opposed it. I told him that the board had not adopted a formal position, but I summarized what the insights had, what the conversations had led to, and spoke to the fact that the board was included in stakeholder discussions specifically to envision whether this was implementable. So I don't know that I particularly helped the sponsor because I couldn't give, you know, a black or white answer, or I'm sorry, the chairman, but I think that I appreciate it very much. This is one of those rare instances where a member actually contacts the regulatory board and wants to hear what the regulatory board has to say. And I know that conversation is being replicated with the other two boards. In the case of the Arizona Medical Board, they do not support this bill. So I don't know what this bill's chances look like in the crossover chamber in the House of Representatives. I'm not hearing any questions. Senate Bill 1035 has grown into a monstrosity of a bill. It was amended on the floor, and I think that you would be best served if I sent the members a fact sheet that summarizes what the floor amendment brings to this bill. Of course, this was the bill that the board was concerned about because it changed so drastically the composition of the membership. What it does now is it sort of creates a variation of that, of the membership composition. It removes a behavior analyst off of the board. It retains the public members of the board, but it prescribes how the remaining members, psychologist members, how many must be not in active practice. They must be not practicing, you know, retired or something similar. And the reason for this has to go back to goes back to the speculation that I offered when I initially talked about this bill. This bill is an answer to try to minimize, mitigate, or prevent a board from making a determination, from taking an action that amounts to a market restriction. And so that is important in a historical, broad regulatory sense, because the Dental Board of North Carolina, the Supreme Court of the United States, I think in 2010, 2011, made the determination that that board had, in fact, restricted the free market with one of its decisions. So states have implemented strategies to not create or foster that kind of event from reoccurring, and some have adjusted the composition of their board member or board composition, you know, in terms of the balance of professional members and public members and so forth. Apparently, there is a claim that's been filed in the state of Arizona, not with this board, but someone is making a claim that a regulatory board did make a market restrictive decision. And so it's a $10 million notice of claim. So this bill, the amendment to the bill, is trying to, you know, get to a resolution of that, or you know, circumventing again this from happening. I think that there are some elements of this amendment that are really complex, and I'm not sure how practical they would be at the, you know, in terms of implementing. It proposes that a council of executive directors exist for purposes of evaluating complaints that a board made a market restrictive decision, and it compels us executive directors to serve a term of appointment to that council to essentially serve as an independent tribunal for those claims and to return recommendations back to the original board who made those determinations. And there's a lot of other stuff going on with this bill that sort of relates to this idea. Dr. Davey, this will resonate with you on some level. There are several jurisdictions where there's a general act, there's a general set of regulatory statutes that applies to all professions, and then each profession cited in that general act, they have their own statutory and administrative rules over which, you know, they are responsible, that they enforce, and so forth. So again, just having a general set of statutes that prescribe in all instances what all boards shall do, are restricted from doing, what applicants shall do, and so forth. That's the concept here, is to work on what would be, I think, a very ambitious bill, I assume next session, to introduce that kind of general regulatory act in an effort to squelch the possibility that a board may go rogue and make a market restrictive decision. Michigan, Brian, or Dr. Davey, excuse me, state of Michigan is, I think, a very good example of that. I think South Dakota is similar. I am not remembering some other jurisdictions, but I do remember Michigan's being, I'm most familiar with that one.
So the earlier part of what you said, Ms. Pakkanen, sort of, I'm just trying to wrap my head around, if there is any recent psychologist, I can think of one or two, who have voluntarily surrendered their license, they would be eligible to be board members.
Thank you for asking that question. That is addressed in the amendment, fortunately. The specific language states that four members shall be members who have never had their license revoked or suspended or have voluntarily surrendered their license in lieu of suspension or revocation, and who are former licensees who are retired in this state or who have a valid license under this chapter and are not currently practicing. That's a lot of language. It also proposes some interesting strategies too, such as if a vacancy on a board is not filled within a specific amount of time, it grants a board the latitude to approve a public member appointee to the board, which suggests that we would have to be in the business of accepting applications for public members. But it also stipulates that if an appointment of a professional member is made to a board and the Senate does not do its due diligence to conduct the confirmation hearing within 1 year, the appointment stands. As the statute reads today, if the confirmation hearing is not conducted and the Senate does not approve of the appointment within a year, then that person served for a year and they're done. So an awful lot going on here. And I think you need to see this fact sheet to sort of appreciate every nuance that's going on here. So really what I just described is what I think is most germane, but I will send you that fact sheet to review if you're interested. Then, a bill to restrict, to prevent state employees from working remotely with some exceptions. That is moving. It did pass the Senate. I know there to be a lot of consternation about this bill on the part of state agencies, if only because there isn't enough space for all of us to return to the offices. There was a lot of attention given to the fact about the millions, tens of millions of dollars that were saved by demolishing buildings, releasing rent, and so forth, and saving, you know, Arizona's, rescuing Arizona's budget at a time where it was really critical. So even though the backers of this bill say there's no fiscal impact, in point of fact, there is, I don't know where the dollars would come from to create the office space for everybody to go back to the Capitol Mall. I think that's all I want to talk about today. Maybe one more. No, that's it.
Well, appreciate as always, Ms. Packin, and all of the attention you paid to this, because yeah, it does affect and you know the daily functioning of the board in the future, and helps us sort of have a outlook as to what's coming. And so, thank you for that. In the interest of time, new agenda items number 20. Is there any request? Yes, Dr. Flint.
I'm wondering about the feeling of having Walden representatives come back for a little check-in, considering there's so many situations coming up that are involving their leadership.
Ms. Packinen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Flint, for reminding us that this was a request that was made by the board, I think associated with the original application matter. So, yes, there are intentions to do that. And so the staff had discussed bringing the Walden representatives at the closure, at the conclusion of the matter that that was tabled today, frankly. So what we didn't know was that this would be a theme where, you know, potentially other trainees and licensees were concerned. So it may be that the board, I think, needs to make a determination. Does it make sense to bring Walden representatives to the board before the whole story is told? Or is there another timing that seems warranted and necessary? So I'll take direction from the board.
Thank you. And we can't discuss it because it's not on the agenda, but Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Donner. Yes, Ms. Hagen, I think that the Walden, from the theme, from the pattern we've seen, this is not going to stop after the next one or the one after that complaint, but it seems to be a chronic pattern. And so I think if we wait for a resolution of one item, there's just simply another item to take its place. So I think to throw a dart at the calendar and let the board staff determine when that would happen to bring them before the board.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. And remember, there's six or seven other trainees that have suffered from this, and we want to quash that quickly.
Again, maybe as part of that is, what institutions is Walden answerable to? Because it could be like a referral to them. But again, it's, I think, covered. All right, then I'll exercise my moderate. Okay, sorry, Dr. Medina.
I am sorry, really quickly. Is there a last code word? Because I don't think there was one given at 12:30. I think there have only been three given. Do we need four, or three is good enough?
I can go ahead up. Give out another one. The next CE code word is spaghetti. Spaghetti.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of people drop off at 12:30, so maybe this last code word was not captured by somebody who was expecting.
Yeah, that was the training program at COPA. The interns were viewing our session, and it was until 12:30, the requirement.
Okay. All right, so we are adjourned. It's 12:59. As always, thank you, everybody, for your diligence and hard work.